Web is turned on and the meeting will come to order. We're going to want to conclude this meeting in the next couple of minutes, believe it or not. We have some extremely important items on the agenda, and I think most people are thinking this is going to take hours and days to do, but I don't know if Jacqueline wants me to announce this, but Commissioner Johnson's child has dropped. And it's due any second, so we'll see if we can't help facilitate matters here. If you...
We'll still provide due diligence to every docket item, of course.
We will, yes. This is the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission meeting of March 11, 2008. It's approximately 9:30 a.m. We are in the State Capitol Building in room 412 in Pierce, South Dakota. My name is Commissioner Gary Hansen. With me today are Commissioners Dusty Johnson and Steve Kolbeck. I will first check the phone to see who is on the line with us. And if I don't call your name after I'm done, please let us know that you're on the line. Meredith Moore.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Mark Anderson.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Dave Callahan?
Not present.
How did you do that?
This is Mark Anderson.
I recognize your voice. Thank you, Mark. Don Marker?
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Bob Schutzel? Mary Lonas?
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there anyone else on the line whose name I did not call? Mark, will Dave not be joining us?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. The agenda is going to be changed just slightly because of the degree of discussion that will probably take place on HPO 7-001. We will move that to the end of the agenda as a courtesy to the applicants and interveners on the other dockets so that they do not have to hang around as we go through that process. Consumer reports, first item up on the agenda is consumer reports, and the Director of Consumer Affairs, Deb Gregg, will present that information to us. Good morning, Deb.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Hansen. The Commission has received a total of 116 contacts since the last report was prepared for the February 26, 2008 Commission meeting. 18 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 27 of the contacts involved electrical services, 10 contacts involved natural gas services, 2 contacts involved electrical and natural gas service, 15 contacts involved cell phone services, 27 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, and 17 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 426 of the 498 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved, and 2,281 of the 2,337 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved.
Thank you, Deb. Are there any questions? Mr. Kolbeck. Commissioner Kolbeck.
Yes. Deb, could you tell me about the CP&I? Are you having trouble with that?
We have noticed that has started to affect our office. If consumers contact our office, we usually have been able to take complaints over the phone and just take their information and call the company. They're now requiring us to get something in writing from the consumer, giving us access to their information. So we've now had to get complaints in writing or have them fax or email. So we have a great variety of ways to get complaints in our office. So we usually can get an email from them in a few minutes or fax.
Okay. Now, they're still categorized, though, under telecommunications, electricity? And
that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Deb. Any other questions? If not, first item under consumer complaints is CT08-001 in the matter of the complaint filed by Chris Weber of Pipco's Garage Incorporated, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, against Reduced Rate Long Distance, LLC, regarding unauthorized long-distance charges. On February 29, 2008, Mid-Continent Communications filed a petition to intervene as a complainant. Should we take Mid-Continent first? Is there anything that Mid-Continent wishes to present, or should we go with staff? Kara?
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. Staff supports the intervention. Mid-Continent was the provider that Pico's garage was using, and it claims it there was an unauthorized switch involved. So we support the intervention.
Thank you. Does Mid-Continent have anything to add?
This is Mary Lonis. We have no additional information.
Thank you very much. The question before the commission is, shall the commission grant intervention to Mid-Continent Communications? Is there anyone else here in the audience who wishes to present information on this item? If not, commission action? Oh, yes. Meredith Moore? Oh, excuse me. The train's out of the station just a little bit, Meredith, but we can pull it back.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of Reduced Rate. We don't have an objection to Mid-Continent's intervention in this particular docket.
Thank you very much. Commission action?
In the case of CT08-001, I move to grant intervention to Mid-Continent Communications.
A motion has been made. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Under electricity, the first docket this morning is EL05-023 in the matter of the application of XL Energy for a construction permit to build 9.6 miles of the Split Rock to Lakefield Junction 345 kV transmission line and add facilities to the Split Rock substation. XL filed a letter on February 29, 2008, asking for approval to move a structure. So we will hear from XL first.
Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the commission, my name is Jim Wilcox. I work for XL Energy in South Dakota. On the phone today with me is Mark Anderson, project manager for this 345 kV project. And has Dave Callahan joined us yet?
No, he will not be joining us, Jim.
Okay. I want to begin by saying I come today with my hat in my hand. XL Energy takes full responsibility for the deviations from the stipulation agreement that we signed last year in this matter. I've got a diagram and some photos I'd like to share with you just to help me talk through what we think happened.
Thank you. Do you have photos for Mrs. Johnson as well?
Sure. We've got some extra copies. Let me help start getting your bearings on these three, the diagram and two photographs. But first on the diagram, you can see running east-west on the bottom of this is I-90. This 345 kV line runs along the north side of I-90, east of Brandon, South Dakota. So you can see some red circles with some numbers on them. Number 34 and 35 are structure numbers where these structures are to be planned to be located, and that's what we're talking about today, and particularly structure number 35 is a question. Then you see there's a north-south line with some red circles, W1 and 30, 35 and 36. That's an existing WAPA 345 kV line that runs north-south east of Brandon. And so our new 345 kV line will tap into that north-south line at structure 35, wherever it is to be located. So that's kind of the background. The issue today, in my mind, is around the placement of structure 35. The original plan placement was near the blue circle, just to the south and west of that red 35. There's another 35 and a blue circle. that is the approximate location of where that structure 35 was originally planned to be placed. And it's our understanding that our contractor, Burns & McDonald, determined that the alignment of that location would place undue mechanical stress on structures W1 and structure 36. So they determined to move the location of structure 35 to the location depicted with the red circle in the diagram. Then I've got a couple of photographs that follow this diagram just to kind of help you visualize this place. Attachment 2, the first photo, is a photo of structure 35 that I took. Structure 35 I took last week looking west from I-90. And so a couple of things to notice. You can see this, the billboard at the lower left there, and there's a fence, and the interstate highway ditch sort of jogs over to the north there about 50 feet. It's kind of an unusual thing, but as I understand, surveyors and there's a couple of reasons it happens, but periodically the interstate highway has to jog over a little bit, and so you'll periodically along the interstate highway you'll see these fence lines where the fence line will actually jog over 50 feet. So this happens to be one of those locations, and that so you kind of got to look at this to realize that there's a 90 degree angle that the fence line jogs over to the north there. And then the next photograph, attachment 3, photo 2, is same structure 35 looking north now from I-90. And you can see the WAPA, north-south WAPA line is visible in the background. So that structure 35 is set in the middle of where the WAPA line is existing and is intended to tap into that north-south line. All right. I guess the point I wanted to make with a billboard and that photograph is that, you know, the original plan for structure 35 was to be right there, pretty much on the front side of the billboard. And so, you know, I think one of the reasons that structure 35 needed to be moved is it would have, you know, blocked the billboard. So that's one thing. The other thing I guess I want to make sure that I'm clear about is that we believe the new location for structure 35 is within the easement that we have purchased for this line. Now, we think we had agreement on the location of structure 35. I will let Mrs. Johnson speak for herself on that. But I've had a conversation with her myself last week about that matter. Our failure here really is in not meeting the letter of the stipulation agreement. We agreed in writing that we would come back before any modification from the center line of this power line was made, before we made those changes. And we now believe there was a failure in communication between the contractor and the company. We became aware of this only after the change had been physically made. And I want to assure the commission that we take agreements we make with the commission seriously, and that we're taking steps to put a process in place that will ensure that this kind of communication gap cannot happen again. So we're here now posthumously seeking permission to locate structure 35 where it rests now, and I respectfully request approval of this petition. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just one question from me at this juncture, and then we will hear from, unless the other commissioners have a question as well, then we'll hear from Mrs. Johnson. But you made a statement that you are comfortable that this rests within the easement. That obviously is something that doesn't need to be debated if it can be proven and actually shown. Do you have something to show us that
on the
that is
on attachment one, the diagram, there is a white dashed line that I believe depicts the boundaries parameters of the easement, and that it shows that structure 35, in my understanding, rests within the easement that we have acquired.
It's your understanding. Someone obviously communicated that to you. You first said you believed it, and now you're saying it's your understanding. You're telling us that you're certain that it is within the easement.
It's XL Energy's view that it is within the easement.
All right.
That we required, yes.
Okay, thank you. Did any of the commissioners have any other questions at this juncture? Commissioner Colbert.
Yes, Mr. Wilcox. The structure is in place, correct?
That is correct.
So the footings are laid. This picture that you showed us is the, on page one, that is the red 35, correct?
That's right.
Okay. That's it.
Any other questions at this time? Mr. Smith.
Jim, on the photograph, you know, just looking at that, maybe you could explain, and you talked about the jog in the interstate related right away. You know, can you explain it? It looks like when I look at that, I see what appears to be a fence of some type behind the pole. And do you know what that is and how that might relate to where this pole is? Or is that just a temporary structure for construction?
I'm not sure.
What is that?
What pole you're referring to, John?
I'm referring to the big pole with the wires on it.
Okay. Technically called a structure,
right,
John. look at the diagram first, and you'll see the white line that comes east-west, and then it goes north and then east again. So that depicts essentially the fence line, the interstate highway fence line. So it shows you that there's a jog. This diagram is an aerial photo. It's a top view. So you can see from that that there is an approximately 50-foot jog in the fence. It's a little harder to see that from looking at the photo, but you have to let your mind see that. The fence comes, if you look to photo one then, you can see the fence line starting from the way on the left side of the photograph coming along to the east, and then it reaches the billboard, and then that's about the point where it takes a 50-foot straight north jog to within about 5 feet of the base of the structure. And then it goes east again. Does that help, John, answer the...
Yeah, and I think part of it's the photograph, and part of it's my eyesight isn't
all that
great.
That's a two-dimensional photograph, and it's a three-dimensional.
Right, and it looks like, when you really look at it carefully, I was trying to determine whether the pole is on the interstate side of the fence.
It is not.
Okay, it's on the landowner's
side.
That's right. Of the fence. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it has to be. The law prevents us from encroaching on the interstate highway right away, other than to overhang the ditch.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions, Commissioner Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, in the interest of disclosure for Excel, I might just note that I think when the Johnsons became concerned about this, they did contact me. We had a brief conversation. I then relayed the information as I understood it to Ms. Kramer, and I think that maybe put this filing into effect. I don't believe my conversation with the Johnsons prejudices me with this docket at all, but I certainly want to make sure Excel knows, and if you feel more comfortable on having me on this case, I'd be happy to oblige.
No. The Johnsons are not related to the Johnsons in this situation.
No, yeah, that's right. Almost all the other Johnsons are my brothers.
No further questions. Thank you. Mrs. Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner. I don't know where to start. This has been quite a project for us. We discovered on January 8th of 2008 that Structure 34, if you look at his map, was located 21 feet 6 inches towards the north, which would be towards the white line in the easement area, correct? On the same day, we discovered 35 was poured. These structures were both poured before this date because there was no covers over the cement. The cement was all hard, and it was ready to go, okay? Our question was, why was Structure 34 21 feet out in the field? Because we were told it would be on the fence line, as shown in the photo here. Okay, we negotiated. I've got testimony here. I've talked to Mr. Callahan. I've talked to Mark Anderson. I talked to Todd Hunt, the project manager. How we found Structure 34 was 20-some feet off where it was supposed to be was through the dump truck driver that was hauling the dirt. No communication from Excel. No communication from anybody about this project. If it hadn't been for the dump truck driver asking where we wanted the dirt, and my husband went up there because he said, what kind of dirt is it? And the dump truck driver said, I don't know. He said, you come and look at it. And that's the first time we discovered that these poles were where they weren't supposed to be. Okay? So we went through with Excel. I went through the project manager. I went through Mr. Callahan and all these people I've talked to. And no one could give me any answers of why that pole was out there. I requested maps from Todd Hunt, who is Burns McDowell's man. I requested maps from Mark Anderson. I requested maps from Dave Callahan. No one gave me any maps. The map Mr. Hunt was working off of was numbered, and I gave this number to Mark Anderson and asked him to pull it up on his computer, but he didn't I never heard from him after that on this map. The map Mr. Todd Hunt was working off of on this project on site on January 8th was 2112-401, dated January 27th of 2007. The only maps we have seen of this project are the ones that came when we would sign the easement, and everything was on the fence line. And on these maps that Todd Hunt had on the 8th of January were the same maps that were given to us, and everything was on the fence line. Now, someone decided to move this tower from whenever, January 27th, 07, until January 8th of 2008. But we were never notified or told what was going on. And then we had to get back and get answers from these people. First of all, they said they had to pour the tower there. As Mr. Wilcox said, if you look at his photo with the sign, they contacted the sign company, and they said the sign company wouldn't let them take the sign down. It's our sign in South Dakota Beef. No one ever contacted us. The next one was the DOT fence line is crooked. And Mr. Smith, if you look at that line you were talking about, that comes off that brace on that. There's an upright there, a guy in a bucket up there. That line comes over to the pole. That is not a fence. And if you look from the truck that would be on the left of the pole, that those are braces that they use to hold their trucks steady when they have men up there. That is not a fence back there. Okay, I don't know when these pictures were taken. Yesterday there was a flyover, and I'm assuming it was someone to do with the construction project. And the only reason I know there was a flyover is because we was out sorting cattle, hauling them to pasture, and I saw this plane. And Excel or someone does fly these electrical lines, usually with a helicopter to check them. But this was a plane. So I just saw it go, and it was just kind of unusual that it would be flying over yesterday afternoon between noon and 1. So, anyhow, they have not answered my questions when I ask them. We had to hire an attorney. I asked them all along not to hire an attorney. And my last talk with Mr. Dave Callahan was on the 4th of February. And he said they would buy the land. All along, through all these easements, we've been told through Excel, we don't want to buy your land. We want an easement on it. So that's understood. Now, this is Structure 34 I'm talking about. Now they want to buy the land, okay? They would give us $1,500 for this. And I try to explain to them this is a lifetime for us. Never being able to plant a straight crop, never being able to drive a tractor between the fence and the structure to spray it, we would lose 6/10 of an acre, which is a lot, and that pole just created a new setback zone for us on that whole stretch of road there. And no one would ever address it, you know. So the next thing I know, I get a call from my attorney's office, and Excel, Mr. Callahan, this is from their attorney, Monty Walls, and apparently this came through Mr. Callahan. And there's some things in here. I did tell Mr. Callahan the first thing I would like him to do was move the structure. Absolutely not. He said the structure cannot be moved. It takes 3 months to make a new pole because each pole is constructed for each base. Every one of these upright poles is made for the base it is poured for it. So that structure is for that. That's what he explained to me. Okay, I said, if that's out of the question, and they said, we'll give you $1,500. No. I said, I want $250,000, or you lease the land from us for $6,000 a year for the life of the structure. You know, and they said, that's the last I heard. He said he felt there was non-communication for this, what I felt was right for compensation, and I told him. And then he said, well, what do you think it costs to build one of those structures? And I stated to Dave Callahan, That's you can find that information out yourself. I'm not an engineer. I don't have a clue what it would cost to build one of those structures or take care of it. And I told Dave I wanted to talk to someone else. Well, the next thing I know, the attorney's office calls and sends me a letter and said that I'm being totally unreasonable, demanding money from them. They would offer us from, okay, this is what they state. Frankly, Xcel would prefer to resolve this matter on the Johnson's mutual agreement terms. Xcel and it has agreed to increase the amount it will pay the Johnsons from $2,500 up to $10,000, okay, to resolve this situation. They say in this letter that I refuse to let them go on our property. The only thing I said was, do not work on Structure 34 until we are resolved. I never, ever told anyone that they couldn't go on the property. So then we come back here, and I get a letter, or I hear about this, I guess, and now they want Structure 35. They want permission to leave Structure 35 where it is. Well, first of all, there's two main discrepancies here. Structure 35 was poured at the same time Structure 34 was. And now they are applying to you. Somebody has dropped the ball here. And I don't know if it's Xcel, I don't know if it's the engineering company, or who it is. And I just want us to be treated fairly in this matter and have them communicate with us. I have never received, as was I was supposed to get stated right here, this is dated October 2007, signed by Karen Kramer. The applicant shall provide each landowner across whose property the project is constructed with the following information. A copy of the commission orders. Never had it. Detailed safety information describing reasonable safety precaution existing with, near the ROW. Construction maintenance damage. The commission's address and phone number. The applicant shall also comply with all terms and conditions set forth in the findings. I have no information from Xcel on this matter at all. Never received it. I have all my information that I've gotten from this whole project in one place, and we never, ever received a letter from them. You know where I got this? This morning from Karen. And this is the first time I've seen it.
Thank you. Does that complete your testimony?
Yes. I have one question.
Sure.
I want to know what section that this Tower 35 is in. I want Xcel to answer that for me, please.
Can staff answer? What section of land?
Land.
Okay.
There seems to be a discrepancy if it's 25 or 26, so that's why she would like Xcel to explain.
All right. Does Xcel have that answer?
Mr. Chairman, I do not. Mark Anderson is on the phone. Mark, do you have an answer to that? Do you know? Mark, are you there?
Yes, this is Mark Anderson. I've been told that the structure is located entirely within the easement that we have.
Do you know what section it is in?
I don't have. No, sir, I don't. I don't have the easement in front of me.
I think Mark's saying that we believe that it is within Section 25. Mark, it's... Mark, is it possible that part of it's in 26? Does this sit right on the section line?
Jim, I don't have the easement in front of me. It's possible, but I've been told that the structure is entirely within the easement that we have.
Has Dave Callahan been able to join us?
Give me just a minute.
Does staff have an answer to this? Is staff, for some reason, privy to information that NSP and everyone else is not?
Actually, I think Mrs. Johnson was showing me this morning, and is it your easement, right, or something that shows it's in Section 26, and so that's...
That's why there's a question.
That's why there's a question. So I didn't know if maybe Xcel could clear that up.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we can't right now.
Mrs. Johnson, do you have any other unanswered questions for Xcel at this time?
Who provides me with maps of this project?
Could you use the microphone, please?
Who provides me with maps for this project?
Xcel should be providing you with maps.
Has anyone from Xcel visually inspected Structure 34 or 35?
Excel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me answer the question about the maps. Xcel Energy is contracted with Burns & McDonnell to make this construction. And our agreement with them provides that that they will I'm sorry, I'm losing the words that, that the agreement says, but it that they will
Xcel's contractors are required to provide the information and communication with the property owner.
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Yes, and for example, the stipulation agreement that we agreed to, we provided that to Burns and McDonald, and our contract says that they will follow the stipulations in that agreement. And so in every other agreement we've had with these folks, you know, that has happened. And so in this case, for some reason, we had a failure in that communication. And so I'm being very careful because we have a separate action with Burns and McDonald on this exact matter over this failure in communication. So I don't want to overstate.
Thank you. Overstate. Would we appreciate the multiple challenges that exist there. Would you please provide a map showing the exact location, which an ordinary person without special knowledge or education, although Mrs. Johnson, I'm sure, has a lot more knowledge of this than any one of us, but that it would not be tricky for anyone to ascertain what the location is by looking at the map?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Did you have any other questions?
I wanted to ask them if anyone has visually inspected the site from Xcel.
Certainly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can say I've been there myself.
Have you been out there on foot, or have you just drove by and flown over?
I've been out there on foot last week. When I took these pictures, I was on foot.
Okay. Were you on the dirt? Were you on the easement, or were you on the interstate side?
I was on the dirt road that's on the west side of that parcel.
Okay.
Yep.
Did you notice anything strange there on that dirt road where they tore up the wetland?
Yeah.
And the dirt in the corner?
Yes, I saw some ruts. Yes, I did.
Who will be?
Xcel Energy will take care of that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mark Anderson. I was able to locate Mr. Callahan, and he can speak to the question regarding where the structure is located, Section 25 or 26.
Good. Yeah. Good morning, Dave.
Morning. It's on the north section, structure 35 is on the north-south quarter line of section 25, and it's just north of the center of that section.
Dave, would any of structure 35 extend into section 26?
No. It's almost in the center of section 25.
I don't think so, Dave. It's on the edge. It's very near the edge.
I'm looking at a land drawing.
Mr. Callahan, would you hold on for just a minute, please? We obviously are not going to arrive at a conclusion that the commission is comfortable with at this during this process, and we'll allow you folks to provide a map to Mrs. Johnson showing exactly where the location is. We won't use any more of the commission's time on it. Did you have any other questions that need to be answered right now, Mrs. Johnson? Thank you. Thank you. Are there any, first of all, we'll go to staff for their information, and then we will go to commission's questions.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and just to, Mr. Wilcox said that, you know, there was a failure on Xcel's part regarding the modification, and I think included with that is also, as Mrs. Johnson pointed out, the failure to provide documents to the landowners, information to the landowners. So there was more than just failure to seek our approval here. There's been more than that. This incident, I don't believe, rises to the level where staff would recommend a suspension or revocation of Xcel's permit here. However, staff is troubled by the fact that in spite of the procedure that's laid out in the stipulation that really has been there since I've been here 15 years, and that's been boilerplate language before I came, that the only way we found out about this deviation was that the landowner found out and was unhappy with where the poles were going, both 34 and 35, and notified our office. It never came through the company, which is how it's supposed to occur. You know, to recap the information, the contractor here determined the change was needed in August of 2007. That stipulation between staff and the company was signed in October of 2007, yet we were never notified of that. The commission approved the stipulation after that, again, without any indication these poles are being moved. Foundation was poured in January of 2008. And again, for the first time, we find out at the end of January that this is occurring. And I just find that very troubling on our Xcel's part. Staff and Xcel have completed a number of these transmission line dockets over the years. So, again, this language is not new, nor are the obligations of the contractor. You know, having just found out this morning that none of the information is provided, at least to the Johnsons, I don't know if all the landowners also failed to receive this information or if it was just the Johnsons. Again, I find that very troubling. It seems like we go to an awful lot of work here, and I'm not sure to what end. So, bottom line, I think the commission can give approval to moving Structure 35, because that's the one we're talking about. The Johnsons are okay with that. Don't want to hold up the project here. So I think you can give approval to that. I would like the commission to highly recommend to Xcel that they sit down with Mrs. Johnson and staff today, and we get this all worked out and figure out what they need to make this thing right in their world. There are questions of maps, the wetlands, the dirt. She told me this morning there are frozen chunks of concrete laying out there. Planting season's coming, and this stuff has to be taken care of, and I think it needs to be taken care of quickly. You know, one thing we could do, and I hesitate to even bring this up, the commission could order Xcel to provide written verification that each contractor and each landowner receive the documents as required under the stipulation. The reason I hesitate to do that, and it's not because it's work for staff or anything like that, but then it almost becomes staff's burden in this matter, and it's shifting the burden from the company to staff to verify that the stipulation is being fulfilled. And I would think their signature on that in October, it was their obligation, not staff's. But as we can see, the ball got dropped, and I think something needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. With your suggestion that staff, Xcel, and Johnson sit down and attempt to resolve this, has staff been involved in any of the discussions, attempting to arbitrate, so to speak?
When I was originally contacted at the end of January, I made some suggestions to both Xcel and Mrs. Johnson, and Xcel didn't think much of my suggestions, apparently. They weren't provided a map. They didn't do a few things. That's fine. They were merely suggestions on my part. Since then, the Johnsons were able to work out getting Structure 34 taken care of on their own. As she pointed out, she just didn't want lawyers involved or anything that cost her money. Unfortunately, lawyers did have to get involved, and it did cost them money here. As to 35, again, it was all a done deal before we were involved. That was all done in January, early January, and we weren't involved till the end of January. I've worked with her. I think we've talked on the phone a couple of times this last week, tried to provide her documentation. I've been providing her the stuff that Xcel has been providing us, and that's this morning when she came in and I provided her the last data request, and then she saw the order requiring the landowners get all that information. That's the first time she had seen that. So we've been working together, but I'd really like to see this thing taken care of quickly.
Thank you. I have one other question, and then I'll turn over to commissions. Xcel, is this project being held up pending the action by the commission on this item?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think without approval, then it would mean we would not be allowed to energize the line until we have this approval. I mean, I think that's reasonable.
Are you at that juncture now where you're ready to energize the line?
I need to defer to Mr. Anderson to ask him of the status of the construction. Mark, when will we energize this line?
We'll be energizing that line within the next couple of weeks.
It's your intent to energize within the next couple of weeks.
That's right.
Thank you.
Any questions from the commissioners?
Mr. Wilcox, what are the ramifications of these contractors? We know that they've made some mistakes, to say the least. What is our assurance that if we would approve 35 and the Johnsons are okay with that, what is the proof that we have that it's not going to happen again, I guess? Are all the bases set? Are there ramifications to the contractor? What has been done?
Commissioner, I have to choose my words carefully. I believe Xcel Energy is entering into an action with the legal system, with Burns and McDonald, on this matter. We have an intent to put in place processes that would attempt to prevent this kind of miscommunication from happening again. This, to my knowledge, is the first time this kind of thing has happened. And we've built a lot of power lines, and so I'm not quite clear, why it didn't happen. So it's our intent, certainly, to put in some processes that would prevent it from happening again, certainly.
Are all the bases poured to the state line?
Yes.
Are all the poles up to the state line?
I have to ask Mr. Johnson, Mark, are the structures, what's the status of the construction, Mark?
We are complete with erecting structures from the white line, where structure 35 is, west to a point immediately north of the Angus Anson plant. And then we're erecting a couple structures in the river valley between the highway and the Angus Anson plant. When we get those structures erected, we'll string the wire, and then we'll energize that section of the line.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for the commissioners? Mr. Smith?
I have a Ms. Johnson, would you mind going up to the mic? I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. Maybe pull the mic over. Thank you. I heard you speak of pole 34.
Structure 34.
Structure 34 also being out of line.
Yes.
Out of its spot. And then I heard Ms. Kramer here say that's now been resolved. Can you verify maybe for the commission both, I guess, where does Structure 34 stand?
Structure 34 is due west of Structure 35 on the map he gave you. You can see Structure 34. That structure was taken out and reset after we discovered on January 8th that it was 21 feet out into our field.
So they moved it back to where it was supposed to be. Okay.
But I try to negotiate with them and tell them I didn't want attorney fees. Mr. Callahan took the liberty of contacting our attorney and turning it all over to him, saying I was making unreasonable demands. After a couple days there, they came back. I got called at 10 to about 3:30 in the afternoon. I don't have the exact date. It's back there, but I got called about 3:30 in the afternoon and told them I had to let Xcel know by 5 if we wanted $15,000 or they would take the structure out. All I asked for in the first place was remove the structure. So I don't know what happened in a matter of a day. This structure could come out. We could have saved all this time, all this energy, and everything if they just would have said, okay, we can move the structure, but they couldn't. And they said the reason they couldn't move it is because 35 had to go where it was because the sign company wouldn't let them take the sign down, which is not true because no one ever contacted us. And that's why that structure had to be poured there. The next excuse was the DOT's fence jogs. The DOT's fence does jog, but it doesn't jog. Has anyone measured the feet that fence jogs? No. And I think that needs to come up. Has anyone done a land survey out there? This is all done by GPS, according to the engineering company, McDowell, or Burns McDowell, is all done by GPS. And Todd Hunt, who is their guy, said, that's why I couldn't have any maps, because they're all on the computer. I said, generate them off the computer for me. No one will do it. So I don't know if anyone has ever gone out there and checked this land out with a surveyor. You know, I know they came out and surveyed, or never, I don't know if they surveyed or not, but they did check to see where their easement area would be and if they could get their cement trucks through on their easements. I saw them out there then with the little tripod looking up and down, but I've never seen anyone out there with the structures. And not that I need to be. I shouldn't have to be doing this.
Okay, as of now, then, in your mind, is 34, is that solved?
34 is fine.
And the any residual damages to land, has that been, have they cleaned that up and that's back to
the cement chunks are down in the corner in mm-hmm. the wetland. Okay, and mm-hmm. Excel said they would take care of that. Okay,
okay.
That's fine, because I know they probably couldn't haul them out in the wintertime. The only thing we requested was that when they took that structure 34 out to replace it, that they would take it down 6 to 8 feet into our field so that we come through with equipment, we're not going to be hitting their cement under the ground that they poured. We were told by the contractor supervisor that they took it down 6 feet. So as far as I know right now, it's down 6 feet, but I have no way of knowing that, so except for the contractor supervisor.
Okay, and then with respect, now you mentioned 0.6 acres. Is that what I heard you say?
That's what Structure 34 was sitting on, was 0.6 acres, is what they thought we would lose for farm ground. That was Structure 34, okay?
Okay.
We are not losing, I got to say this to be fair, we're not losing very much farm ground mm-hmm. to Structure 35 because it is partially in on the fence line, okay? And the other guy, but it's more on our side than it is on their side. But where it sits, it's in grass area, I think it'll be okay. But my problem is the truth not being told because of the billboard not coming down. That is not why they can't put that structure in the corner. They have to be dead center under the Wahpeton line. And they are. Where the structure is, they are dead in the middle. No one from Excel has said that here. That structure has to be dead center according to the engineering company. No one from, well, I guess I shouldn't say that. Dave Callahan did tell me that too when I talked to him. So.
And I guess with respect, Commissioner Johnson, excuse me, and just so I understand now, the various offers made back and forth, then, you know, the number $250,000.
That was my request because, you know what, plain and simple, mm-hmm. I was sick and tired of them.
Okay. So that isn't based around, you know, some kind of valuation of that.
Yes, it is. It's what it would cost us to give up mm-hmm. productivity on that land. It's what it would cost us in time to spray around it. It's what it would cost us if we hit this structure with our equipment, you know, because we don't have tractors that'll fit with equipment behind that'll fit between a fence line and 18 feet because your structure base is 5 feet across at least. And these are always metal to the middle of the structure. If you have a round circle, you start from the middle of the structure and then out the way they measure.
But that isn't based upon, like, a per-acre value for the 0.6 acres.
Well, they said in the letter to the attorney they based it on the, you mean the 250? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
No, that is for me. That is for what we would lose in productivity, a new setback zone, and we still have created a new setback zone by 35 being 51 feet, 6 inches out there.
Okay. I just wanted to understand the basis for that, and I think you've explained that. Thank you.
Okay.
Commissioner Johnson, did you have a question?
Yeah, I've got two, if that's okay. Questions for Excel. I think, Mr. Wilcox, others, there are a couple of things that bother me. Would Excel be willing to commit to sending the commission a letter with a CC to the Johnsons, letting us know when Excel has taken care of any ruts, cement chunks, other debris, and a sort of damage that would have been done with actions to 34 and possibly to Structure 35?
Certainly.
Okay. And then secondly, this communication, this, you know, at least one set and maybe other landowners not getting the information that we presume they got. And if you're not in a position to commit to this today, I understand, but I would be interested, if my fellow commissioners are, in perhaps having an Excel provide staff with your updated landowner list, and then have Excel pay for staff to conduct a mailing to the landowners saying, you know, if you here's, you know, bullet point of things you should have received. If you haven't received those from Burns and McDowell or Excel Energy, please contact the commission so that we can ascertain exactly how large is this communication breakdown. And if you're not able to commit to that today, I understand, but then I'd like a letter from, again, if my commissioners and my other commissioners are amenable to this, then I'd like a letter from Excel indicating whether or not you would be in a position to do that. And since I'm throwing staff under the fire here, of course, Ms. Kramer sort of suggested it, but if staff has concerns with that, please throw them out.
I guess I need some time probably to sort through what this request means, and we can certainly follow up and get back to the commission on that, on this one.
Thanks.
Any further questions at this time? Staff, did you have anything to add?
Staff has nothing, and Commissioner Johnson's suggestions are fine. I mean, we'd be willing to look through that and confirm with everyone that they got the information that was required.
Thank you. At this time, I'll close the hearing to commission action. Commissioners, obviously we're all concerned there's a significant failure of communication, not only with the landowner, with this landowner, but potentially other landowners, and certainly with the commission itself. And a number of exacerbating situations here. I'm inclined to not, in spite of staff's suggestion that we, at this time, approve the move of the structure, I'm inclined not to approve the movement of the structure until after staff and the Johnsons and Excel have had an opportunity to sit down and discuss this issue, and certainly those items that have been discussed up to this juncture from the standpoint of providing maps where the exact location is, and as well as the other information that Commissioner Johnson just spoke of, should also be included. And I would throw that out for discussion at this point. It's not a motion, but I'd like to know what your thoughts are.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's fine. You know, I had originally thought that we could, you know, pursue sort of separate paths, you know, take care of 35 and then deal with sort of the residual issues. But I suspect your suggestion is probably a good one. That keeps us on the front burner. It ensures that everybody will work expeditiously because I think everyone probably wants to get this line energized, and it's probably not a bad suggestion.
Excuse me, Commissioner Kolbeck, did you?
No. I have trouble not granting approval for a move when it actually enhances the quality or the structure to make it stronger. But I do sympathize with Mrs. Johnson, and I'd just like a commitment from, I guess, us or staff that we can make a move on this on their next meeting, the 25th. I don't want this to drag out for till April or May or anything like that. If I think that's my only concern is that if it is structurally feasible, it makes the structure better. I'd like us to make sure that we get it done at the next meeting.
That certainly would be my intent. It's just that when we take it, so to speak, off the table, there's that, I recognize Excel as an honorable company, and we certainly haven't had them coming in on a monthly or even an annual basis with problems of this nature. This is certainly an unusual situation for them. If they had been in a – perhaps I'm being a little harsh by recommending that, but it leaves that hammer and that desire to get it completed. Commissioner Johnson, did you have something?
Well, I wonder if there's a hybrid solution here, and I would ask advisors to chime in too if I'm off base. But, you know, perhaps the commission could, you know, grant the approval to move the structure, but note that Excel is not allowed to energize the structure until some of these residual issues regarding the commission's order are resolved. That will allow construction to go forward, but we'll keep this thing on the front burner.
That's a good suggestion. I was a bit uncomfortable with stopping it completely, especially when we recognize the opportunity for wind energy and things of that nature that this energizing this line will provide. So I appreciate that suggestion.
And Mr. Johnson, can I ask you one more question? It is my understanding that 35 is an okay spot with you.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's the lines are already strung.
Okay.
And everything's ready to go there. The Burns McDowell guy told me on Saturday that they will be out of there by today or tomorrow.
Okay. So and your beef really isn't with that structure.
No, but I want to know what they're going to do about the easement for that structure. That's my question to them.
Okay. Then I would totally agree with Commissioner Johnson, Chairman, that the structure may not be the root of the problem, but the other things that we've spoke about should be handled before they energize it.
Exactly. Appreciate that. So I will make a motion at this time that the commission in docket EL05-023 grant Excel's request for approval to move the structure, however, that the line shall not be energized until such time that the commission gives permission. We don't look for seconds. Is there a discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbert?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. That moves us to electric docket 07-010 in the matter of the filing by Sioux Valley Southwestern Electric Cooperative doing business as Sioux Valley Energy for approval of revised service territories as a result of annexation by Brookings Municipal Utilities. The question before the commission is, shall the commission dismiss and close the docket? Ms. Semler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Semler for staff. Service territories are all normally approved by the commission, with the exception, however, of when a municipality annexes a new territory. Only then, if there's a disagreement in the price that municipality must pay for that property, only then does it come before the commission. This docket, this matter simply shouldn't have been docketed, so its dismissal is merely administrative. And I can answer any questions if you'd like some further detail.
Thank you. Any questions by the commissioners at this time? Is there anyone else wishing to address this item before the commission? I'll ask again because on occasion someone has their mute button on when they're trying to speak with us. Is there anyone who wishes to address this? If not, commission action.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the commission dismiss and close the docket.
Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. EL07-011 has been removed from today's agenda. Item number 4, electric docket 08-004, in the matter of the filing by Basin Electric Power Cooperative Incorporated regarding its notification of intent to apply for a permit for an energy conversion facility. The question before the commission is, today, shall the commission designate an affected area pursuant to SDCL 49-41B-6, and shall the commission designate a local review committee in accordance with SDCL 49-41B-6? Good morning. I assume you're with Basin.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Casey Jacobson, Corporate Counsel for Basin Electric. And this morning with me, I have Wade Nyberg, our local counsel in South Dakota, as well as Chris Miller. He's the Senior Environmental Project Administrator for our proposed NextGen facility, as well as to my right, Mr. Kurt Pearson. He's our Projects Coordination Representative. As you are probably aware, Basin Electric filed its Notice of Intent for a proposed energy conversion facility near Selby, South Dakota on February 20th. And as part of that notice of intent, an affected area must be defined. We have reviewed staff's recommendation of a proposed 25-mile radius from the plant site. And on its face, it does sound reasonable, although we would like to offer in some evidence for your consideration on this matter. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Kurt Pearson to discuss that.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Kurt Pearson. I'm Project Coordination's representative for Basin Electric. In that capacity, I'm in some way a jack of all trades, but among my responsibilities is the housing program for the Dry Fork Station, which is currently under construction just north of Gillette, Wyoming, and that is to provide housing for the workforce. So I am very familiar with our efforts to provide housing for the incoming construction workforce. I also am in charge of the socioeconomic impact analysis work being done by the consultants for the Dry Fork Station, past tense, that work has already been done, and the work that we are consulting with a firm known as EDAW, E-D-A-W, and they are doing that on our behest for the NextGen proposed project. And it's a simple thing to draw a circle on the map. And it's one of the first things I did, is I drew a circle on the map, and I said, let's look at all the towns, large and small, that fall within that circle. But in looking at that, that may not be a fair approximation of the amount of time that it takes a worker to commute to the job site. We have encountered, since October 17th, the groundbreaking for the Dry Fork Station, considerable reluctance on the part of the construction workforce to travel any distance at all. We have actually, under contract, hotel rooms 60 miles away on an interstate highway, and I'm paying for empty hotel rooms on Basin's behalf. Workers will not drive 45 minutes on an interstate highway to commute to the job. That is in part due to the high gasoline prices. It's in part due to the hard work that they do. They're tired at the end of the day, and they would like to get back to a hotel or an apartment as close as possible to the job site. This presents upon Basin's interest to accommodate those workers. As we proceed with this project and go through the permitting phase, it's very, very important that we are able to attract the highly skilled and qualified specialized craftspeople to this project. And to come to the Mobridge-Selby area from out of state, we need to provide them with housing as close as possible to that. For those reasons, I asked our EDAW consultants to prepare a drive time map, and then I asked them to superimpose simple circles on top of the drive time map. And it does show something very interesting, and that is that a 25-mile radius, many of that area included in that 25-mile radius is a 60-minute drive time or more to the site, something from our very recent experience we find workers will not accept. So I might offer for your suggestions a new way to look at it rather than a simple circle around any project that you might be considering. A drive time map is interesting and perhaps even enlightening. For your consideration only, Basin Electric would suggest a 20-mile radius circle would be somewhat more appropriate for this project.
We have no further testimony on this issue. We'd be happy to answer any questions about the project or this map.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jacobson. Mr. Pearson, in your presentation and saying 60 minutes from, I appreciate the colors on the map from the standpoint of basically an explanation of, I recognize challenges of gravel roads and things of that nature. It doesn't take me anywhere near 60 minutes to drive from Vivian up to Pier. That's 33 miles, not 25, and I recognize that's a divided highway now, but it's never taken me that long. I go hunting in these areas, and it doesn't take anywhere near that long. How do you come up with 60 minutes on that?
That was devised by the EDAW consulting group based on their speed limits that they have in the right side of the upper right side of that. So I may personally agree with you. It might take me a little bit less time if I were doing the same commute, but this is strictly a calculation that they have prepared based on speed limits.
Certainly if they're in the middle of some gravel area, in those areas, it will take 60 minutes. However, from a standpoint of housing, they're not likely to be staying in a farmstead out in the middle of some of those areas. So I would suspect, personally, from my personal experience, that it would take less time, although I don't know how many residences are available in Bowdell or other locations to rent. Do you have some type of information for us in that respect of how many, of where you had rented?
facilities? At this time, Mr. Chairman, no, we don't. We are still in the evaluation process, trying to determine the best way to house the incoming construction workforce. We have no definitive plans at this time, so it's premature for me to make a guess.
And I don't mean to be difficult with this. It's just that one of the things we really look for with construction is that opportunity for dollars to come in and infuse the communities. If the company comes in with trailers and housing for those folks, it means a lot fewer dollars to the communities that otherwise are going to be excited about having the construction take place. Meals and things of that nature are, if they're renting hotel rooms, are usually taken up then, and in the towns as well. I'm sure Mobridge and Selby are definitely looking forward to the construction dollars that would be coming in. So it's a bit of a challenge for me, at least from a standpoint of just saying, yes, we'd love to see you bring in housing. I have to admit I have a bit of a bias against that. So I'll turn it over to the other commissioners while I chew on that. Any questions? Commissioner Johnson?
Oh, I would just, I think, support what you're saying, Commissioner Hanson. I mean, looking at housing is just one reason we have local review committees. I mean, frankly, there's environmental impact. There's not just economic impacts during construction, but rather long-term during the operation of the facility. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to know that there are people in Selby working in Bowdell or people in Bowdell working in Selby. And it seems to me that long-term with a project of this size, I mean, it does seem that there may be people in Harriet and Bowdell, and those local governments and school districts may have an interest in the effect that this facility, if it's constructed, might have long-term. But I do like them. It's a lot of fun to look at the map.
Well, thank you for that. We offer this as a new way, perhaps, to consider the impact area. I might offer, Mr. Chairman and commissioners, that our consultants are advising us, even though it is preliminary, that this will require the use of a temporary construction workforce camp, location yet to be determined. The size of that camp would provide from somewhere between 1,000 and 1,400 construction workers to stay in that one location. This is a very big undertaking. That's why I am reluctant to say much more than that, but it is the advice of our consultants to Basin Electric that Basin will necessarily have to provide a considerable quantity of housing for the construction workforce.
Will you also be providing temporary gas stations and grocery stores and all of those things when you talk about a camp?
The camp itself, if you would envision a full-service camp that does not have gas stations, an option for us would be to have a small convenience store, if you will, located within the camp. Some camps I have toured in Wyoming have that. One camp I saw down by Wamsutter, Wyoming, actually had a physician's assistant in the camp, assigned strictly to the 350 workers that would live in the camp because they felt the county did not have adequate health services. That is not an issue for us. We think in Walworth County, you have the hospital there right in Mobridge. So, but it would be, in any regard, it would be a full-service food service available to those workers in the camp. Breakfast, a sack lunch to take to the work site with them, and then they come back for dinner. So that's a typical camp. Again, we have not pulled the trigger. We have not made final determination on the nature and the content of the amenities of the camp.
Sure. Any further staff have anything to chat with us on this? Mr. Knadel?
I can chat a little bit, I guess. Thank you, Commissioner. What staff did was is provided the commission with three separate maps that showed radiuses of 10 miles, 15, 20, 25, and 30. In a sense, then, we also have a chart that would show, you know, which additions to those different circles would be made by extending out by five-mile increments. The difference between the 20 miles that their suggestion and staff's recommend and 25, I guess, for as far as school districts, you would pull in, when going from 20 to 25, you'd pull in Eagle Butte and Edmonds Central in the school districts, and you would pull in Edmonds and McPherson counties, and you'd also bring in the towns of Bowdell, Harriet, Holden, and La Pala. And by looking at their map, I guess when they're talking about 60 miles driving distance or 60 minutes, I'm assuming they're looking at West River because they have to cross the bridge. Otherwise, if you're going East River, I mean, you can go at least 60 miles plus to the east to get in with that hour time frame they're talking about. The reason staff went with the 25, I guess, is we kind of looked at what the commission did in the past on the Big Stone 2. And that's a brownfield site there. The commission went with a 20-mile radius there. They also included, you know, a couple additional towns outside the 20-mile radius. And so this is going to be a greenfield site here. And, you know, so we went with the minimum of 25. I mean, the commission can also look at, by going with this 25-mile circle, it doesn't pull in Gettysburg, which is a fairly, you know, big town up there, I guess. And so what we're looking at is the 25-mile minimum that we are suggesting for the affected area. And you might consider pulling in, you know, like I said, Gettysburg, for example, or an additional town, which, you know, a bigger town, you know, is... There's not that many bigger towns up there, I guess, but Gettysburg would be the one of the bigger ones. And so, you know, up there you can drive, you know, basically a mile a minute or less, so to speak. And they're going to have to pull in, you know, the population up there is not that big, so if they're looking at pulling in some local workers, I think they're going to be looking, you know, a considerable distance that people may be willing to drive. And that's kind of how we based ours on, I guess. And if you had any additional questions, we'd be happy to try to answer those.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knadel. Any questions of Bob? Mr. Colbeck.
Mr. Zipstaff, I guess I'd just like to see us pull in maybe the Gettysburg School District into the 25-mile radius, not necessarily for construction purposes, but an ongoing. It could affect their school district ongoing because they're pretty close, although the town of Gettysburg is a little ways away. What kind of a burden, I guess, in other potential review committees, what kind of a burden, excuse me, are we putting on like Akaska and Java, those small communities like that? Do they have to participate or is it at their option?
Karen's going to look at the specific language in the statute just to make sure.
I just, you know, before we pull in a bunch of small towns that maybe are struggling for council members or anybody, I just want to make sure it's their option to participate.
Well, the statute is 49-41B-6, and it says the Public Utilities Commission shall designate the affected area and a local review committee composed of, and then it lists five different, and one of those is the president of the Board of Education of each affected school district. So in my mind, they would have to participate. In the past, these local review committees have generally hired a consultant and had someone do the work for them. I think they pick maybe a smaller committee, then they review it, and then the whole committee gets together and votes on it, anything like that. As to your other question about pulling in the Gettysburg School District, if you look at the chart that we provided, the 30-mile, if you go out 30 miles, you would then, the only thing you would be adding really is Gettysburg School District and then the two cities of Hillsview and Trail City. So you could, you know, if you wanted to, you could just set the affected area at 30 miles and that would take care of that. Well, and then, yes, as Mr. Knadel just pointed out, you may then want to include the city of Gettysburg because even at 30 miles, that still does not capture Gettysburg or Eureka. You know, that becomes the problem. Every time you go out 5 miles, yeah, there's just somebody that sits outside
exactly
2 miles, and so then you pull them in and...
And I guess my only thought for adding the Gettysburg School District is that stretches way farther into the potential affected area. The city of Gettysburg is actually, you know, quite a bit farther away. I think the school district goes considerably north towards the... But I understand what you're saying to go 30 miles. Do you have any concerns about this becoming too big of a working group?
Not for me because we're not on it, but... you know, it does become cumbersome. I mean, the bigger your committee gets. I mean, you're looking at a lot of committee members. On the other hand, this is a big deal. Yeah. And I don't want anyone to think we drew the line just short of them to in some way exclude anyone.
And who is it up to us to make sure that all these members, they choose a new member? We control this review, or we actually...
No, they are almost like a party in and of themselves, this local review committee. They submit a report. They do all the work and findings on, and I think it's 4941B11 that lists like 11 or 12 or 15 things that they have to look at. And that's their report, and they actually present that to the commission either at a hearing or at some later date.
Sure. All right. Thank you.
Further questions or discussion? Might ask how you feel that affects you. Give you an opportunity to chat with us a little bit about what we have been discussing.
Well, I guess Kurt Pearson again with Basin Electric. A larger group simply becomes more cumbersome. I fully understand and I fully appreciate the commission's desire to have all the interested parties represented. And we certainly have no objection to whatever conclusion you might come to. And we will absolutely work to our very best of our potential with whatever committee is formed. If you're looking at a committee of about 30 parties, though, in a 30-mile radius, it truly becomes a congress of its own, and it's quite difficult. So it might extend the time that it would take to come to the conclusion and the recommendation to staff and to yourselves. So that is our intent, is to streamline it somewhat and still have a good representation, a fair representation of the affected area.
Understood. Thank you very much. Ms. Jacobson, did you have anything further?
No, I do not, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Then commission action. Frankly, I'm comfortable with the 25 versus the 30-mile radius, and debate whether we would pull in Eureka and Gettysburg at that point. Both of them are... Thoughts?
I'm completely comfortable with the 25 miles.
Okay. Commissioner Kovac.
I guess without asking somebody from the Gettysburg School District, that was just my thought that, you know, after 2014, if the plant is constructed, that we have a lot of talk about education, and I would just rather that they were included in the beginning. I'd really like to see Gettysburg School District, not necessarily the town, but just the school district included in that 25-mile. It takes it from 31 to 32 people.
Thank you. Any further discussion? I'd like to see Eureka because Jim Melhoff is from Eureka. So.
It's Jureka. It's not Eureka. It's Jureka.
Jureka. Well, I will make a motion, at least for the purpose of discussion, that the commission set the radius at 25 miles and include the Gettysburg School District. Discussion on that motion? Seeing none, Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. There's a second question on the agenda, and I was just asking counsel about that because of our setting the designating the affected area and trying to figure out whether we can, in fact, designate the local review committee, which is the second question. However, he's saying that that is completed by the fact of our actions here already, and we do not need to take an official action on that at this time. The next item, excuse me. Did you? Are you saying we should or should not?
Should appoint, yes.
Yeah. Consul has conferred with consul, and I am going to refer to a list that shows potential local review committees for EL08-004 for the purpose of designating a local review committee in accordance with SDCL 49-41B-6. On that list, it shows from the tribes, the school districts, the counties, and the cities, and I know that some of you were referring to that as we went through the process, and I will make a motion that that list represent the local review committee for the purposes of docket EL08-004.
Plus Gettysburg.
Plus Gettysburg.
School
district.
Thank you
very much. Plus the Gettysburg School District. Thank you. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes aye. Motion carries. HP 07-001 has been deferred to the end of today's agenda, which brings up telecommunications items TC 07-123 in the matter of a filing for approval of a boundary change between Valley Telecommunications Cooperative Association Incorporated and Dickey Rural Telephone Cooperative. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the boundary change and the requested waivers? Will staff be taking this? I'm looking to see if there's someone on the phone from...
Hello, there you are. Margo Northrup from the Ryder Rogers Law Firm here in Pierre. We filed this joint application on behalf of Valley Telecommunications and Dickey Rural Telephone Company. We're requesting that you amend their certificates of authority to reflect some agreed upon boundary changes. As we stated in the petition, this will not affect any of the customers in either one of these territories, and it's actually made to make the boundary straighter and easier for the companies to read on their maps. And I think we should have Bob Schutzley from Valley on the telephone for any questions.
Thank you very much. Staff?
Thank you, Chairman. As the company stated, these boundary corrections do simplify following the new boundary lines, and we just recommend approval.
Thank you very much. Commissioners, do you have any questions?
Everyone has agreed to and signed off, and it's all ready to go.
Yes, as part of the petition, we had a letter agreement between the two companies.
Yeah. It's two different companies, Dickey and Valley?
Correct.
Okay, and then that's another docket. 106 is actually between
Valley
and
James.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we take them both at the same time?
Absolutely.
Mr. Johnson.
It's probably worth noting that for both of these, if memory serves, there are no customers in the affected areas, so this is a paper change.
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you, Ms. Northrup. Any further discussion by the commissioners? If not, is there a motion on TC07123?
I motion on TC07123 that the commission approve the boundary changes.
And the requested waivers.
And the requested waivers.
Any discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. TC07-126 in the matter of the filing of approval of a boundary change between Valley Telecommunications Cooperative Association Incorporated and James Valley Cooperative Telephone Company. Question before the commission is today, shall the commission approve the boundary change and the requested waivers?
Thank you again, Margo Northrup. This petition is identical to the one in the preceding docket. We're requesting that you amend the certificate of authorities to approve the boundary changes between Valley Telecommunications and James Valley.
Thank you, Ms. Northrup. Any questions? Staff?
We would recommend approval.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Commissioners, motion.
I would move that the commission approve the boundary changes and the requested waivers.
Thank you. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. I am going to make announcements just because I know that after we get done with the other one, no one's going to care about the announcements. And then we will take a very, very brief, let's say, 8-minute break. So that anyone that needs 8 and a half minute break
so people can use the bath if they need to.
Can we say 5? That always ends up being 7. If you say 8, it'll be 15.
That's why I said 8.5. I agree with that. The next, the announcements are, the next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held March 25th, 2008 at 9:30 in room 412 of the State Capitol Building. Commission meetings are also scheduled for April 8th and April 22nd. A public hearing was held in docket EL08-001 yesterday at 12:15 at the McKnight Community Center in White, South Dakota. And an interconnection workshop as part of docket EL06-018 will be held March 18 and 19 at the King's Inn and Pier. And the commission will reconvene at 4 minutes after, according to the clock on the web, and the meeting will come back to order. The last item on the agenda is the hydrocarbon pipeline, item 1, docket HP07-001, in the matter of the application of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline, LP, for a permit under the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facility Act to construct the Keystone Pipeline project. Questions before us today is, shall the commission grant, deny, or grant with conditions a permit to Keystone for construction of the project pursuant to SDCL 49-41B-24, or how shall the commission proceed? I'm speaking a little bit more slow, although Sherry, our court reporter, is able to keep up with auctioneers. I will purposely speak a little bit slower when I'm reading. The action, before we take the action on the questions, I would like to note today that this hearing is for commission action. This is a contested case. All of the hearings and processes have been completed, and it's time for the commission to take its action. The commissioners will discuss the issues at this meeting among ourselves and possibly seek the opinions of our advisors or counsel, but we do not take comments or argument from parties or the public. As a result, we will not be taking further comment from anyone here this morning unless a commissioner has a specific question for someone. We've held over 21 hours of public meetings. We've held very, very lengthy evidentiary hearings. We've gone through an extensive process here, and now it's time for the commission, and it's an opportunity for the commission finally amongst ourselves to have some for some discussion. The process today will be as follows. A motion will be made. The motion is then held in abeyance until a commission discusses and adopts the conditions of the permit, if that's in fact what we do. And then after the conditions, if they are adopted, those members of the commission who believe the applicant under the conditions has met the statutory requirements will vote in favor of the motion, and those commissioners who believe, or commissioner, who believe the conditions are insufficient or that the applicant has not met the statutory requirements will vote against the motion. At this time, I will move that the application by TransCanada Keystone Pipeline, LP, for the construction of the Keystone Pipeline project be granted, subject to the conditions approved by the commission today. I further move that action on this motion be held in abeyance pending our action to finalize the conditions. The purpose of this is that the commissioners have chosen, unlike years ago, this commission has chosen not to discuss this docket amongst ourselves outside of an open meeting. We've chosen that in the flavor of the open meeting laws, and from a standpoint, instead, in order to, it's made it challenging, of course. Number one, we're curious what each other thinks about issues, and we feel that all of us are smarter than any one of us, but at the same time, it provides us this opportunity to have discussions. In this case, in order to draw up the conditions, what we did was, with our counsel, Mr. John Smith, we each independently wrote up
those items which we felt were important enough to be conditions for this docket. We sent them to him via email, and we did discuss those with him. He went through a protracted process of putting those together, giving us drafts. We looked over and made comments with him on those and did not discuss it between ourselves. The final draft that we actually have before us, I don't think any one of us have actually had the opportunity to completely read through, although we have read through quite a few drafts, and it's a composite of those. And we believe we've read the whole thing. But we're going to go through it paragraph by paragraph in order to be positive of that. And I will note that it has 57 conditions to it, this particular draft. If we spend 5 minutes on each one of those, we will take 5 hours to go through this process, so we do not intend by any means to spend that much time on it. I will read each condition, and I will ask then the commissioners if they have any comments, suggestions to that particular condition. In this manner, everyone will have the opportunity to hear those conditions as we go through the process. Once all of the conditions have been discussed, we will vote on the conditions. And if there are any contentious conditions, we will vote on them separately, and the majority will rule on those conditions. I will begin with the conditions. The first two conditions are technical in nature, and anyone who is tuned into this, I don't want you to think that those serve as precedent for all of the rest of the conditions, what they're going to sound like by any means. But there will be. I think they are of significant interest. They do appear to cover all of the different instances that we are concerned with, and we are very concerned with making sure we have all of the T's crossed and I's dotted in this particular issue. The first item, and by the way, I think all three of the commissioners are just very much looking forward to this opportunity so that we can move this. I know Sandy is looking forward to having this off of the dining table at home, and I know that each one of us as commissioners are very interested in making sure that we come to a conclusion on this and getting it right. The first item is Keystone shall comply with all applicable laws and regulations in its construction and operation of the project. These laws and regulations include, but are not necessarily limited to, the Federal Hazardous Liquid Pipeline Safety Act of 1979 and Pipeline Safety Improvement Act of 2002. As amended by the Pipeline Inspection, Protection, Enforcement, and Safety Act of 2006 and the various other pipeline safety statutes currently codified at 49 U.S.C. 60101, collectively, the PSA, the regulations of the United States Department of Transportation implementing the PSA, particularly 49 CFR Parts 194 and 195, temporary permits for use of public water for construction, testing, or drilling purposes, SDCL 46-5-40.1 and ARSD 7402-01-32 through 7402-01-3402, and temporary discharges to waters of the state, SDCL 34A-2-36 and ARSD Chapters 7452-01 through 7452-11, specifically ARSD 7452-02-46, and the general permit issued thereunder covering temporary discharges of water from construction, dewatering, and hydrostatic testing. Do any of the commissioners have any comments, suggestions on the first condition? Seeing none,
The second condition is Keystone shall obtain and shall thereafter comply with all applicable federal, state, and local permits, including but not limited to presidential permit from the United States Department of State, Executive Order 11423 of August 16, 1968, 33 Federal Register 11741, and Executive Order 13337 of April 30, 2004, 69 Federal Register 25229, for the construction, connection, operation, or maintenance at the border of the United States of facilities for the exportation or importation of petroleum, petroleum products, coal, or other fuels to or from a foreign country. The Clean Water Act 404 and Rivers and Harbors Act Section 10 permits. Special permit issued by the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Temporary water use permit. General permit for temporary discharges and federal, state, and local highway and road encroachment permits. Any of such permits not previously filed with the commission shall be filed with the commission upon their issuance. Are there any considerations by the commission on item two? Condition number three, the Keystone shall comply with and implement the recommendations set forth in the final environmental impact statement issued by the United States Department of State on January 11, 2008. Any considerations by the Commission on item three?
I would just note, Mr. Chairman, this is something we've done in the past, like with Big Stone 2, and it makes maybe a little bit more sense in a situation like Big Stone 2 where we ruled prior to having a final environmental impact statement, but I think it makes quite a bit of sense here as well.
Thank you. Any other considerations? If not, item four, the permit granted by this order shall not be transferable without the approval of the commission pursuant to SDCL 49-41B-29. Any considerations? Item 5, Keystone shall undertake and complete all of the actions that it and its affiliated entities committed to undertake and complete in its application and its testimony before the commission at the hearing. Any considerations on item 5?
I just want to make sure that the testimony that's on the website, how long will that be available? Just in case.
How soon will that be available?
How long?
Okay.
Are you talking audio or transcript?
The transcript. It should be available, I would imagine, for at least the next foreseeable future. If we're going to go to anything that was testified to, that transcript is going to be our record, correct?
May I answer that, please? This is John Smith, Commission Counsel. As far as I understand the Commission's policy with respect to maintenance of our files for public access on the website, I would anticipate that those would be available forever or until such time as it's become obsolete and you decide to retire those. I really think that's an administrative decision for the commission to make, but those we treat those as public records.
Okay. Well, and in fact, I don't think we've ever put a docket up on the web and then later taken it down.
We have not.
And I was just wondering in years and years to come.
As far as I'm concerned, the plan as of now, and again, we don't know what new technologies may bring or whatever, but I think the intent would be that those files be maintained for public access forever.
Okay, thank you.
The next set of items have to do with...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I would just note that Webb filed some objections to the findings of the applicant, and a number of the objections had to... dealt with the fact that TransCanada, or rather Keystone, indicated that it will do something. And I just think this condition number five makes it clear that, you know, what TransCanada is promised to do, this commission expects it to do.
Thank you. Next set of items are under reporting and relationships. Item six, the most recent and accurate depiction of the project route and facility locations is found in hearing Exhibits A and C of September 2nd, 2006 to the application Exhibit TC 1A and 1C
as modified by the valve and pump station relocations described in Exhibit TC1C of March 5, 2007, risk assessment, 6 overview valve and pump station relocation, overview of the valve and pump station relocation rationale, March 2007, and 7, facility relocation, 070328, valve and pump station relocation rationale, Keystone Pipeline Project, March 22, 2007, and the route deviation maps introduced into evidence at the hearing, Exhibit TC-13 and TC-14. The testimony of Keystone's witness, Buster Gray, indicated that the land acquisition and precise route finalization process was ongoing at the time of the hearing. Keystone shall notify the Commission and all affected landowners, utilities, and local governmental units as soon as practicable if material deviations are proposed to the route. At such time as Keystone has finalized the pre-construction route, Keystone shall file maps with the Commission depicting the final pre-construction route. If material deviations from this route must be made during construction, Keystone shall advise the Commission and all affected landowners, utilities, and local governmental units prior to making such changes and afford the Commission the opportunity to review and approve such modifications. At the conclusion of construction, Keystone shall file detailed maps with the Commission depicting the final as-built location of the project facilities. And certainly, Item 6 is a very important item, as certainly all of them are. However, as we saw earlier today, how important it is to follow that particular condition. Any suggestions by commissioners on Item 6? If not, condition number 7. Keystone shall provide a public liaison officer approved by the Commission to facilitate the exchange of information between Keystone, including its contractors, and landowners, local communities, and residents, and to promptly resolve complaints and problems that may develop for landowners, local communities, and residents as a result of the project. Keystone shall file with the Commission its proposed public liaison officer's credentials for approval by the Commission prior to the commencement of construction. The public liaison officer shall be afforded immediate access to Keystone's on-site project manager, its executive project manager, and to contractors' on-site managers, and shall be available at all times to the Commission staff via mobile phone to respond to complaints and concerns communicated to the staff by concerned landowners and others. Keystone shall also implement and keep an updated website covering the planning and implementation of construction and commencement of operations in this state as an informational medium for the public. As soon as the Keystone Public Liaison Officer has been appointed and approved, Keystone shall provide contact information for him, her, or her to all landowners crossed by the project and to law enforcement agencies and local governments in the vicinity of the project. The public liaison officer's contact information shall be provided to landowners in each subsequent written communication with them. Any comment from commissioners?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Kolbeck, I think we heard a lot during the summer meetings along the proposed route that people were concerned about information and about communication, and we also heard that a little bit this morning. I think having this public liaison officer, this contact, everybody knows who it is, is going to work to really avoid, I think, what could be a lot of potential problems during construction. And additionally, I would just note that I think this will also be good for the Commission staff to be able to have somebody that is going to be on top of the information that we need as soon as we need it.
Absolutely. This will certainly help to facilitate the entire project. Item 8, until construction of the project is completed, Keystone shall submit quarterly progress reports to the Commission that summarize the status of land acquisition and route finalization, the status of construction, the status of environmental control activities, including permitting status and emergency response plan and integrity management, plan development, the implementation of other measures required by these conditions, and the overall percent of physical completion of the project and design changes of a substantive nature. Each report shall include a summary of consultations with the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources and other agencies concerning the issuance of permits. The reports shall list dates, names, and the results of each contact and the company's progress implementing prescribed construction, land restoration, environmental protection, emergency response, and integrity management regulations, plans, and standards. The first report shall be due for the period ending July 31st, 2008. The reports shall be filed within 31 days after the end of each quarterly period and shall continue until a project is fully operational. Are there any comments on item 8?
If we go with traditional quarters, perhaps the end of June might be easier to remember. So that you're dealing with, you know, end of March, end of June, end of September, end of December.
Any concerns with that?
Oh, no, I think that is what it says, because the quarter will end at the end of June, and then they'll have to ignore me. Thanks.
Commissioner Colbeck.
I just have one concern. Each quarterly period shall continue until the project is fully operational. How are we defining fully operational? Is that amount of barrels, or is that just as soon as all the welding is done and they pump any amount through?
Mr. Smith, do you have an answer to that?
I think the understanding is when the project is fully operational,
okay,
meaning at least it's actively engaged in pumping product. I mean, my assumption is there'll be a ramp-up period, but that's the way I understand that, is once you're pumping product through the pipeline, at least through that period, and perhaps commissioners want to. We have some other reporting things in here as well, and
okay,
maybe you can take a look. This is for the general reports. And again, this is a condition that we've had on other permits, similar permits we've issued. The language of this is very similar to Big Stone 2. And those reports have really proved valuable with respect to the Big Stone 2 project.
I was just wondering, fully operational doesn't mean after hydrostatic testing is completed.
Not to me, it doesn't, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, an attempt to contradict myself yet again. I do think this says that the period ends July 31st, and that's fine. It probably doesn't matter. I just wonder if it won't be easier to remember if that period ends at a traditional quarter time frame. Mr. Smith, did you have a rationale for the end of July rather than the end of June?
I didn't, actually. I believe that's a oversight on my part. I was thinking report due on July 31st, frankly, and it's a drafting error, and you caught it, and thank you. I think June would be June 30th. There aren't 31 days in June, is my recollection, would be the appropriate date for the period end.
Well, don't beat yourself up too much. I caught it before I didn't, and then I did again. So,
should we rephrase that to the first report shall be due July 31st for the period ending June 30th, 2008?
You know, I like the way it's written. I would just change July 31 to June 30th.
It has to say when the report is due.
It's due 31.
Oh, I see. You have another sentence then after following that that states that the report shall be filed within 31 days. All right. That looks good. Any concern, Commissioner Colbeck? We'll change that to June 30. Item 9, did you have something?
I'm just mulling that over in my head, whether to say fully operational with product or something. But I think the interpretation is once the project is running on its own feet, I guess fully operational, I can live with that.
Item number 9, until construction of the project is completed, Keystone's public liaison officer shall report quarterly to the commission on the status of the project from his or her independent vantage point. The report shall detail problems encountered and complaints received. for the period of 3 years following completion of construction. Keystone's public liaison officer shall report to the commission annually regarding post-construction landowner and other complaints. The status of road repair and reconstruction and land and crop restoration and any problems or issues occurring during the course of the year. Concerns on item 9? Condition 10. As soon as practicable, following the issuance of the permit, Keystone shall commence a program of contacts with state, county, and municipal emergency response, law enforcement, and highway, road, and other infrastructure management agencies serving the project area in order to educate such agencies concerning the planned construction schedule and the measures that such agencies should begin taking to prepare for construction impacts and the commencement of project operations. Any concerns on condition 10?
I guess one concern is that the financial burden lay on Keystone to get this done, not the local counties or emergency municipal responses. Does that sound reasonable?
I was trying to figure out how to phrase that and whether or not it was already included.
Commence at its expense a program of contacts with state, county.
I don't have a problem with that. Any concern?
Well, I don't think it probably hurts to include it, although from a practical standpoint, I don't think Keystone, you know, has the ability to bill. It probably has the ability, but I don't think if they bill a county for, you know, Keystone, well, let's include it. It certainly isn't counterproductive.
Well, and I guess my rationale for that thinking is if they're going to put on a seminar, is it the local fire department's responsibility to get the building and stuff like that? I would think that would be Keystone's burden.
Well, and I'm probably reading way too much, and I mean, this is not legislation, so, you know, what little I know about statutory construction probably isn't helpful here. But, I mean, if we put it in one, I mean, it's sort of presumed that this is all at Keystone's expense. If we put it in one place, does that mean to imply that the pre-construction conference or that the reports they're filing to the commission wouldn't be with, on their own dime? I wonder if putting it in only once isn't the right way to go.
Well, and that was my concern. I assumed that it was too, and then in my mind I got to thinking, well, we want to make sure that it doesn't fall on those programs. I guess, Mr. Smith, I'll turn to you.
I don't know.
It says Keystone shall commence a program, so I would assume that the.
Right. I think we're really talking, as long as we're talking meetings, et cetera, we're really talking minimal.
Okay.
Expense. I guess my thought, you know, on it, and just my own mind is, when we're talking contacts with people, my assumption was that this would be more a deal of you go to the local fire department, go to the local county officials, and physically go there and just begin. And that's probably already begun, is my understanding. But that this process be undertaken as soon as possible and just really make sure that local governments, et cetera, are geared up at the time this whole thing starts to roll here.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know that there'd be an enormous amount of expense associated with this in my view, but that you guys can have, certainly, you're the commissioners. And
it just kind of tripped in my mind, and as soon as Mr. Johnson had stated that, I agree with him.
Item 11, Keystone shall conduct a pre-construction conference prior to the commencement of construction to ensure that Keystone fully understands the conditions set forth in this order. At a minimum, the conference shall include a Keystone representative, Keystone's construction supervisor, and commission staff. Any concerns with condition 11? Condition 12, once known, Keystone shall inform the commission of the date construction will commence, report to the commission on the date construction is started, and keep the commission updated on construction activities as provided in condition 7. Any concerns on item 12? Under conditions regarding construction. Item 13, except as otherwise provided in the conditions of this order and permit, Keystone shall comply with all mitigation measures set forth in the construction mitigation and reclamation plan, as set forth in Exhibit TC-1A, as modified in the final environmental impact statement, record of decision. Any concerns with item 13? Item 14, Keystone shall incorporate environmental inspectors into the construction mitigation and reclamation plan and obtain follow-up information reports from such inspections upon the completion of each construction spread to help ensure compliance with this order and permit and all other applicable laws and rules. Are there any concerns with item 14? Condition 15. During the course of the hearing, Keystone submitted TC-28, a construction agreement it executes with all affected landowners. The construction agreement includes a landowner option regarding trenching and topsoil removal methods. Keystone shall provide landowners with an explanation regarding these options and shall follow the landowner's selected preference as documented on the construction agreement. At a minimum, however, Keystone shall separate topsoil from subsoil in agricultural areas, including shelter belts in agricultural areas and grasslands, as provided in Keystone's construction mitigation and reclamation plan. Keystone shall utilize slope breakers to prevent erosion at a 2-4% gradient rather than Keystone's proposed 2-8% gradient. Keystone's cleanup and reclamation efforts shall commence immediately following backfill operations. Except where practicably infeasible, final grading and topsoil replacement and installation of permanent erosion control structures shall be completed in non-residential areas within 20 days after backfilling the trench and within 10 days in residential areas. In the event seasonal or other weather conditions prevent compliance with the time frames, temporary erosion controls shall be maintained until conditions allow completion of cleanup and reclamation. Any comments on item 15, condition 15? This appears to be, at one juncture we had 60-some conditions. This appears to be one that brought in several of them, and appreciate your accomplishing that. Item condition 16, Keystone shall cover open-bodied dump trucks carrying sand or soil while on paved roads and cover open-bodied dump trucks carrying gravel or other materials having the potential to be expelled onto other vehicles or persons while on all public roads. Any concerns with item 16? Condition 17, herbicides or pesticides shall not be used in or within 100 feet of a water body except as allowed by the landowner and appropriate land management or state agency. Concerns with 17? Condition 18. Rock excavation from the trench may be used to backfill the trench only to the top of the existing bedrock profile. All other rock shall be considered construction debris. Any concerns over condition 18? Condition 19. Mulch shall be applied on all slopes concurrent with or immediately after seeding where necessary to stabilize the soil surface and to reduce wind and water erosion. Keystone shall implement staff's recommendations regarding liquid mulch binders and specifications for mulch use set forth in Staff Exhibit 7. Any concerns with item with condition 19. Condition 20. Erosion control matting fabric shall be installed on water body banks at the time of final bank recontouring unless riprap or other bank stabilization methods are employed in accordance with federal, state, and local permits and approvals. Any concern with condition 20? Condition 21, if trees are to be removed that have commercial or other value to affected landowners, Keystone shall compensate the landowner for the fair market value of the trees to be cleared and or allow the landowner the right to retain ownership of the felled trees.
The environmental inspection in condition 14 shall include forested lands. Any concerns over condition 21?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we've got compensation in a few places, but this is the one where maybe it stands out the most clearly to me. You know, free market, fair market value determined by whom is the only recourse that a landowner has if they disagree with the fair market value set by TransCanada. Is there only recourse a court of law?
I believe so, but we have attorneys here that can.
You know, I guess if you wanted to undertake some role in that yourself, you know, you probably could do so here.
Well, want is an interesting word.
Well, if that's what you think is appropriate, you know, we heard a dispute this morning about, I guess not strictly speaking compensation, but about easement and related issues. And we heard it. I don't know that we're going to get down to determining what compensation may be due, but sometimes the commission play a beneficial role in working in allowing things to work out without that. And usually, I mean, quite frankly, the odds of the timber value being worthy of a lawsuit is probably not that great in South Dakota, but you know,
wasn't Mr. Smith, there are at least dozens and dozens of trees across much of, no, I just wonder about, I mean, maybe, and if it doesn't make sense, if this is going to be legally troublesome, that's fine, but I wonder if we don't put in, you know, before initiating, you know, court action, you know, the parties shall contact the commission, in an attempt to arbitrate. I mean, I'm a little reticent to have us get involved in private disputes over, you know, compensation. I just also know that there is the potential of a lot of landowners who feel like they're not getting a good deal but don't really want to hire an attorney.
I guess my comment would be maybe they could come to the commission and we will find someone to determine fair market value if it went to that. If they feel they're being mistreated, they can come to us, and then we could maybe designate a third party to determine market value of those trees instead of us doing it ourselves.
I'm going to guess that this is going to be a small claims court matter, that there won't be times in which there will be significant amounts, and there is already a process in place county by county for that purpose. I personally would think that we'd want to allow that to function as opposed to bringing it before us and acting in some capacity. There's some confusion already with eminent domain and where it starts and ends, and I would prefer we don't confuse that.
Well, I think you both make very good points. You know, Mr. Islov also suggested that since this is a commission order, perhaps the typical complaint process we already have might be utilized for somebody who truly felt like they didn't have another recourse. I don't feel like the wording of this condition probably needs to be changed. So, thanks.
Thank you. Condition 22, unless a wetland is actively cultivated or rotated cropland, or unless non-cohesive soil conditions require utilization of greater width, the width of the construction right-of-way shall be limited to 75 feet or less in standard wetlands. Any concern with item 22? I probably shouldn't ask this. I guess I won't. I think that there were a number of issues as we went through this process on the feet, whether it should be 85 or 75 and such. And if everyone's agreeing to 75 at this juncture, I'll allow it to pass without disagreement. 75. 23. Unless the wetland is actively cultivated or rotated cropland, extra work areas shall be located at least 50 feet away from wetland boundaries, except where site-specific conditions render a 50-foot setback infeasible. Any concerns with item 23? Condition 24, vegetation clearing shall be limited between extra work areas and the edge of the wetland to the construction right-of-way. Any concerns?
a question on, we didn't get to extra work areas. Do we define that in some, is that necessary, Mr. Smith, to define that?
I don't think so. What that indicates is areas for the storing of materials, equipment, that is outside of the normal construction right-of-way.
Okay, thank you. Any concerns on item 24? Condition 25, wetland boundaries and buffers shall be clearly marked in the field with signs and or highly visible flagging until construction-related ground-disturbing activities are complete. Any questions on 25? Condition 26, extra work areas near water bodies shall be located at least 50 feet from the water's edge, except where the adjacent upland consists of actively cultivated or rotated cropland or other disturbed land, or where site-specific conditions render a 50-foot setback infeasible. Clearing of vegetation between extra workspace areas and the water's edge shall be limited to the construction right-of-way. Concerns on 26. Condition 27. In the water body areas, work area boundaries and buffers shall be clearly marked in the field with signs and or highly visible flagging until construction-related ground-disturbing activities are complete. Questions? Concerns? Condition 28. Spoil from minor and intermediate water body crossings and upland soil from major waterway crossings shall be placed in the construction right-of-way at least 10 feet from the water's edge or in additional extra work areas, except that in-stream spoil from streams greater than 30 feet in width may be temporarily stored in-stream when stream flow conditions warrant such treatment. Any concerns on 28? Condition 29, vegetation maintenance adjacent to water bodies shall be conducted in such manner to allow riparian strip at least 25 feet wide as measured from the water body's mean high water mark to permanently revegetate with native plant species across the entire construction right-of-way. Any concerns on 29? Condition 30, the width of the clear cuts through any windbreaks and shelter belts shall be limited to 50 feet or less. The width of clear cuts through extended lengths of wooded areas shall be limited to 85 feet or less. Any concerns with item 30? Condition 31. Keystone shall follow all of staff's recommendations regarding road protection and bonding. Such recommendations include A. Keystone shall coordinate road closures with state and local governments and emergency responders. B. Keystone shall implement a regular program of road maintenance and repair through the active construction period to keep paved and gravel roads in an acceptable condition for residents and the general public. C. After construction, Keystone shall repair and store any deterioration caused by construction traffic such that the roads are returned to at least their pre-construction condition. D. Keystone shall use appropriate preventative measures as needed to prevent damage to paved roads and to remove excess soil or mud from such roadways. E. Pursuant to SDCL 49-41B-38, Keystone shall obtain and file with the Commission a bond in the amount of $3 million in 2008 and $12 million in 2009 to ensure that any damage beyond normal wear to public roads, highway, bridges, or other related facilities will be adequately compensated. Such bonds shall name the Commission as obligee in favor of and for the benefit of such townships, counties, or other governmental entities whose property is crossed by the project. Each bond shall remain in effect until released by the Commission, which release shall not be unreasonably denied following completion of the construction and repair period. Are there any concerns with Condition 31?
I just have one question. How are we going to get this information to these, obviously public highways and bridges, would be the state, but these township people, are we going to send any, and counties, are we going to send anything to the local township board and the state or the county superintendent to make sure they're aware of this? Is that an obligation we should maybe put on Keystone? Actually, they have to speak to all of them already, don't they?
Yeah, we've provided for that, and we've provided for, you know, I think we've provided for fairly continuous updates. You know, if you want a more specific reference in here.
Yeah, I think now that I kind of talked myself out of the question because I know that they have to require the permits to go under the road in the first place. I just want to make sure that they, that these county boards and township boards understand that there is this bond in place.
I will, you know, if you want something in there, sure, put it in there.
I guess other commissioner suggestions on that to require them to send out a letter or any type of notification that this exists?
Commissioner Colbeck, I think you're right in their meetings that they have to have with the local highway and road officials. I think that'll probably be sufficient.
Or maybe mention that they have to mention this bond when they do require the permit?
If you want, I could just add a sentence in there that...
On receipt of their permit, they need to mention...
That local governmental, and including county and township officials, shall be advised of the existence of the bond.
I would like that.
I think that's reasonable just to have them provide that information to make it clear.
I'll do that.
Thank you. Condition 32. Due to the nature of residential property, Keystone shall implement the following protections in addition to those set forth in its construction mitigation reclamation plan in areas where the project passes within 500 feet of a residence. A. To the extent feasible, Keystone shall coordinate construction work schedules with affected residential landowners prior to the start of construction in the area of the residences. Keystone shall maintain access to all residences at all times, except for periods when it is infeasible to do so, or except as otherwise agreed between Keystone and the occupant. Such periods shall be restricted to the minimum duration possible, and shall be coordinated with affected residential landowners and occupants to the extent possible. C. Keystone shall install temporary safety fencing when reasonably requested by the landowner or occupant to control access and minimize hazards associated with an open trench and heavy equipment in a residential area. D. Keystone shall notify affected residents in advance of any scheduled disruption of utilities and limit the duration of such disruption. E. Keystone shall repair any damage to property that results from construction activities. F. Keystone shall restore all areas disturbed by construction to pre-construction condition. Are there any questions, concerns on condition 32?
I think with regard to F, I seem to recall a discussion during the tail end of our formal hearing. TransCanada, I mean, wanted to make sure that they had the flexibility to, if it was better than that they were in compliance. I can't imagine anybody complaining about having a road better than it was, but does F need to allow that flexibility? From a practical matter, I'm not sure that it matters, but.
Do you want me to just add in the words, at least? Or better.
At least is fine.
Yeah.
Any further concerns with condition 32? Condition 33. Keystone shall coordinate project activities with the South Dakota State Fair Administration to make best use of fair resources for traditional users as well as construction workers. Any concerns with 33? Condition 34, construction must be suspended when weather conditions are such that construction activities will cause irreparable damage unless adequate protection measures approved by the commission are taken. Concerns?
I would assume that this provision is to, if there's too much water, they're making too many ruts, that's what this condition is about, Mr. Smith.
I think so. And as we saw in an earlier condition, you know, when we're dealing with, for example, stream crossings, you know, in certain flow conditions, for example, and I think we used a qualitative as opposed to a quantitative term, but, you know, the deposition of spoil in a stream when there are flow conditions that are going to result in excessive turbidity is not a prudent thing to do. And I think that we're talking about the same thing here, yes. Where runoff, excessive runoff, or other damage could be reasonably expected to occur.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I can think of at least one other instance where weather would be there was a line of questioning by one of the interveners regarding the fusion bonded epoxy application during conditions that were quite moist, and precautions can be taken, but at some point you probably shouldn't apply the FBE in the field anymore. So that's one more that occurs to me.
Any other concerns with item 34?
Can I just add, is there anything you feel that needs to be added to this specifically, or?
No, I was just making a question in general to make sure that this is going the way I want it. I thought it did. I didn't want to misunderstand it.
Okay, thank you.
Condition 35, reclamation and cleanup along the right-of-way must be continuous and coordinated with ongoing construction. Any concerns? Item 36, all pre-existing roads and lanes used during construction must be restored to a condition that will accommodate their previous use, and areas used as temporary roads during construction must be restored to their original condition. Concerns? Condition 37.
May I just, and I shouldn't be probably asking a question because I put this together largely from a lot of this is staff's recommended conditions, but one thing that occurred to me there, might there be circumstances where local government or whatever would not want temporary roads, if there are any, and I don't know that there will be any, but if there are, if they want them maintained, ought we put in an option here for the relevant local governments to opt to have those be left sure. in place rather than removed?
Sure. Just add something at the end, unless otherwise agreed to with. Or how would you phrase that?
Well, something to the effect of except as otherwise requested or agreed to by the applicable local governmental entity.
Or words to that effect.
Right, something okay. like that.
Any concerns with that? Seeing none. Condition 37, Keystone Shell, prior to any construction, file with the commission a list identifying private and new access roads that will be used or required during construction and file a description of methods used by Keystone to reclaim those access roads. Concerns? Condition 38, in the event the winter season delays successful completion of decompaction, topsoil replacement, or seeding, until the following spring, Keystone shall prepare and obtain a winterization plan. The commission and affected landowners and or governmental units shall be notified. Any concerns? Off the record, how are we doing, Sherry? Okay, good. Back on the record. The next section deals with operations, detection, and response conditions. Item 39, Keystone shall construct and operate the pipeline in the manner described in the application and at the hearing, including the Keystone's exhibits and in accordance with the conditions of this permit, the PHMSA special permit, and the conditions of this order and the construction permit granted herein. Are there any concerns with condition 39? Condition 40, Keystone shall require compliance by its shippers with its crude oil specifications in order to minimize the potential for internal corrosion. Any concerns with condition 40? 41, Keystone's obligation for reclamation and maintenance of the right-of-way shall continue throughout the life of the pipeline. Are there any concerns with 41? Condition 42. In accordance with 49 CFR 195, Keystone shall continue to evaluate and perform assessment activities regarding high-consequence areas. Prior to Keystone commencing operation, all unusually sensitive areas as defined by 49 CFR 195.6 that may exist, whether currently marked on DOT's HCA maps or not, should be identified and added to the emergency response plan and integrity management plan. In its continuing assessment and evaluation of environmentally sensitive and high consequence areas, Keystone shall seek out and consider local knowledge, including the knowledge of the South Dakota Geological Survey and the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks and local landowners and government officials. Are there concerns over 42? 43. The evidence in the record demonstrates that in some reaches of the project in northern Marshall County, the Middle James Aquifer is present at or very near ground surface and is not overlain by sufficient impermeable material to isolate it from superficial infiltration of contaminants. The evidence also demonstrates that this aquifer serves as the water source for at least one significant public water supply system and several domestic farm wells. Keystone shall identify the Middle James Aquifer area in Marshall County as a hydrologically sensitive area in its integrity management and emergency management plans, except in areas where Keystone can demonstrate that the aquifer is overlain by sufficient unoxidized glacial till or other impermeable material to isolate it from infiltration of contaminants in the event of a release from the project. Keystone shall similarly treat any other superficial aquifers of which it becomes aware during construction and continuing route evaluation. Are there any concerns with item 43? 43, of course, deals with a extremely important part of this whole process and something that a lot of the folks were quite concerned with. Item 44, prior to putting the Keystone pipeline into operation, Keystone shall prepare, file with PHMSA, and implement an emergency response plan as required under 49 CFR 194 and a manual of written procedures for conducting normal operations and maintenance activities and handling abnormal operations and emergencies as required under 49 CFR 195.402. Keystone shall also prepare and implement a written integrity management program in the manner and at such time as required under 49 CFR 195.452. At such time as Keystone files its emergency response plan and integrity management plan with PHMSA or any other state or federal agency, it shall also file such documents with the Commission. The Commission's confidential filing rules found at ARSD 2010-0141 may be invoked by Keystone with respect to such filings to the same extent as with all other filings at the Commission. If the information is filed as confidential, any person desiring access to such materials or the Commission staff or the Commission may invoke the procedures of ARSD 2010-0141 through 2010-0143 to determine whether such information is entitled to confidential treatment and what protective provisions are appropriate for limited release of information found to be entitled to confidential treatment. Are there any concerns with 44? Condition 45, to facilitate periodic pipeline leak surveys during operation of the facilities in wetland areas, a corridor centered on the pipeline and up to 15 feet wide shall be maintained in a herbaceous state. Trees within 15 feet of the pipeline greater than 15 feet in height may be selectively cut and removed from the permanent right-of-way. Are there any concerns with 45? Condition 46, to facilitate periodic pipeline leak surveys in riparian areas, a corridor centered on a pipeline and up to 10 feet wide shall be maintained in an herbaceous state. Are there any concerns with 46? Condition 47, at the hearing, Keystone's expert witness, Brian Thomas, testified that there do not currently exist any viable and cost-effective remote sensing or monitoring systems that could either be installed along the pipeline, particularly at sensitive locations, or employed in aerial and or ground surveillance activities to detect volatile organic compounds or other indicators of potential leaks. The Commission believes that such technologies, when available, could increase the effectiveness of visual surveillance and augment the SCADA system and mass balance and other leak detection methods that Keystone will employ. The Commission accordingly directs Keystone to keep abreast of the latest developments in such technologies and report to the Commission on or before April 1, 2010, on the status of innovation in such pipeline leak detection equipment and methods. Are there concerns on 47? I have one if anyone has. I know in at least one of the communications that there was additional time frames on this that we required, I believe it was this one, that we required Keystone to not only report to us on or before April 1st, 2010, but in subsequent years.
Obviously I've been in a tough place here because I've got three of you to try to please, and I've tried to do that, and at least there were opinions that having ongoing endless reporting is probably both counterproductive and not fair. And I think the idea here was to just have the company take a... I think this is perhaps somewhat similar to... I think it's somewhat analogous to the kind of condition we put on Big Stone regarding innovations in CO2 capture, etc. But I think the thought here was that to require that forever may not be reasonable, but that's for the commissioners to talk about and decide.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I also appreciate the difficult situation you were in, serving three masters, so to speak, and having to select and pick. As we've been going through this, I'm sure all of us are noticing different areas where you've had to make that decision. I would ask the fellow commissioners on this. My only concern with this is that we provide a situation where they have to report to us by April 1st, 2010, but then they can report, gosh, it's not available yet, and a year later, 2 years, 3 years later, when it is available, what about then? What do we do to be certain? Have we given up our hammer, so to speak? I would like to see, I don't know that they need to report to us annually, but when that technology is available, I would like to see them implement it. How do we get to that point?
Well, and here was my concern, Mr. Chairman. You know, the commission, I mean, this is a citing docket, and we don't have authority over, interstate crude oil pipelines and their safety mechanisms. And I think there's a lot of case law that bears that out. And so I was increasingly uncomfortable with a reporting requirement in perpetuity with regard to what technologies they had in place for leak detection. And it seems to me if we did it on this slice of leak detection, could we do it for any technologies with leak detection? And at some point I think we, and I don't know if it's 10 years from now or 50 years from now, at some point we get a little far away from what the purpose, I think, of the citing process was.
Those are all very good points. I
I guess I'm going to lean on the side of I know it may be cumbersome. Gives us an opportunity to meet with them. I don't think it's really a huge challenge for them to stop by and chat with us a little bit. It is so important, and I know it's, and I don't mean by any of my statements to reflect on how you feel about this, because I know that mitigation and remediation, I know that you're very concerned with where we go from here and to make sure that we safeguard the waters of the state. I just, notwithstanding what you said and the strength of your argument, which I have to agree with, I'm being arbitrary and capricious in wanting to see it take place anyway.
Well, and to me, you know, this is technology that doesn't currently exist. To me, what about breakthroughs in SCADA technology, or what about breakthroughs in you know, satellite communication links with the SCADA system? There are just dozens of ways that leak detection mechanisms can improve over the course of the next 100 years, and I wasn't clear as to why we should single out this one.
Well, I would be comfortable in saying that the Commission accordingly directs Keystone to keep abreast of the latest developments in such technologies and report to the Commission on or before April 1st, 2010 and in all subsequent years on the status of innovation in pipeline leak detection equipment and methods until such time as the Commission, I wouldn't phrase it quite like that, but similarly along that line.
Is there any difference between doing that and requiring that they keep us up to date on technologies with regard to, you know, the remediation of oil spills? I just think there are so many different pieces of this puzzle that the federal government, that both law and case law has made it clear that this is their sole responsibility. And I'm not saying that I'm happy about that, but I'm just nervous about putting in conditions that I feel like are not appropriate given the jurisdiction of this commission. And again, I think it's I'm not sure why we would single out leak detection systems as opposed to other technologies and other parts of operating a pipeline.
Sure. For me, I can only speak for my own feelings towards it, and that is that this process is the detection process. It's to prevent the need for going in and having to remediate a challenge. I just think that detection is so important that we need to make sure that we have the absolute highest capability to accomplish that.
Would you be would it grant you greater comfort, Mr. Chairman, if we had reporting perhaps, every third year until some date certain, say 2016 or 2019? Again, I'm going to have a real hard time, I think, getting – I want to reach consensus on this, but I think reporting in perpetuity is a big burden, and if we did this for every energy conversion or transmission facility, we'd have dozens upon dozens. Now, we just haven't done this in the past, and I don't know if this is the right precedence, at least in perpetuity.
Absolutely. I think that was, in fact, one of the positions in one of the sentences that existed there, that in approximately every 3 years there would be reporting up to a certain date, and that certainly would be acceptable.
Perhaps, four such triennial reports, and so concluding in 2019.
Well, technology has been advancing rather rapidly. I think that would work out for me. I'm comfortable with that. Commissioner Kolbeck.
I guess with that, the triennial report was, I'm very comfortable with that. Could we put something that could be continued if needed by the commission in 2019 for review after the commission 2019? Because it'll be different. a different commission, a different day, a different time. And maybe then things may have changed. That's my only worry about going to 2019.
I mean, in essence, Commissioner, I just view that as a reporting requirement in perpetuity. I mean, it's principally the same thing. It's saying the commission has the authority to do that. And I do think if we look out to a date certain, and of course it doesn't really matter what I think. It matters what two of us think. But to me, if it's a date certain, then we're saying that this is tied to our specific concerns with regarding to this siting docket. I mean, this thing could be around for decades. And if we feel like the federal government's current jurisdiction over safety and leak detection and operation of pipeline isn't sufficient, then I'm excited to go, you know, I'd like to get that changed. I mean, I'd work with you, but I just think perpetuity's tough.
Well, I guess my feeling is that the only reason we would leak detection is the one thing that could lead to our involvement. If there was a release, leak detection is the one thing I think that would prevent that, and I guess that's why that would be my...
Well, we wouldn't
put it higher on my list of concerns.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. My apologies. This commission wouldn't be involved with any release.
That's very true.
Yeah. Involvement, I guess, is a relative term to an extent there. Obviously, we wouldn't be out working with the process, but I think it would affect the commission to an extent.
Well, and I just am looking historically, like with the Williams release, you know, if that was cited by the commission, you know, I'm not aware that they had any involvement, any formal, and I think your point is well taken, right. You know, involvement can come in a lot of different ways, but I don't think there was any formal involvement in that remediation.
I would be comfortable with reporting every 3 years at the commission's request, and then that way if they came up with new technologies, then the commission at that juncture 3 years, 6 years from now, 12 years from now, would just simply at that point abandon its request.
Well, and maybe that's not a bad way, you know, to say report to the commission on or before, you know, April 1st, 2010, and then thereafter, as specifically requested by the commission, no more often than every 3 years, because I do think at some point future commissions, you know, I mean, I don't know. That's more acceptable to me than a hard and fast perpetual reporting requirement, certainly.
That would eliminate some of the challenges that I think on both sides it allows for the reporting, and at the same time could eliminate that from a standpoint of every three, the perpetuity. Is there any challenge?
I would agree with that. I think that's a good... good compromise.
I've done it again. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No,
I thought you were done.
We're going to give him a ruler.
To me, one of the reasons I've exhibited some resistance to this is really, these end up being, you know, and I don't know whether it's 5 years or 10 years or 100 years after the fact, paperwork exercises. Not only for the applicant, but for commission staff. And again, we have dozens of big transmission projects and energy conversion facilities and wind farms. And at some point, if we required them all to do this, but we don't have the authority, say in the year 2040, to require that they instill such remote detection devices. And so we've got the information, which presumably we could have found on the internet in the first place. We made them put it together, but we don't have any ability for them to force them to do anything. So that's part of my concern. The commission doesn't have any statutory authority to do anything with the reports once they're with us.
I understand that fully. The situation is it brings them before us and gives us the opportunity to query why they're not using it, and it's a public forum, and it gives the opportunity for news media and for everyone to question the veracity at that point. And I think that knowing a company, especially the size of Keystone, that they would want to implement, especially in those, I would assume they'll want to implement anyway, but this will assure us that they are, in fact, accomplishing that.
And it's probably worth noting for us, we've got 6,000 miles of hydrocarbon pipelines in this state, and we haven't requested, you know, this commission hasn't seen a need for that information from those facilities. We've never asked for it. They wouldn't have to give it to us if we did. But again, I believe that we've got environmental regulators in place who are looking at this, and that at some point this is going to be outside of the commission's bailiwick.
So we're at a juncture where we've discussed a potential of having a sentence regarding, and we'll allow our wordsmith, Mr. Smith, to figure that out, on the reporting every 3 years at the commission's request, something along that line. Is there agreement on that sentence?
If there was a way that the... You know, what I don't want is for next week then the commission to just say, well, now we've had a request for you to do this on an ongoing basis. I mean, if we could somehow tailor the wording very narrowly so that it, you know, the commission would have to request it for each instance, as opposed to just a blanket request. Because again, I'm opposed to sort of a blanket request or a blanket requirement.
That's why I stated reporting every 3 years at the commission's request. So if the commission doesn't request it, then it wouldn't be required.
And as long as the request is, that wording is tailored to mean a single request for a single report and not a series of reports, I'm fine with that.
I'm not following what the series of reports would be, but excuse me.
If the commission were to send a letter to the applicant in the year 2010 saying, we request that you file reports every 3 years for the next 40 years, that is a request for reports, no more often than every 3 years. But I do not believe that that request would be appropriate or within the authority of the commission to make.
Yeah, and it's certainly not within the intent of this sentence that I was suggesting adding. Commissioner Colbeck, did you? I saw you reaching there.
I think that we need to stay away from, as Commissioner Johnson said, I'm trying to rationalize on both sides. I'd like to see if there's things that they can do and are not doing, as I think Commissioner Hansen is saying, and I understand Commissioner Johnson is saying that even if they could do something, we can't force them to do it, and it's a perennial request. I would just like to see at a commission's request, they must come in and tell us. I would like to stay away from years or anything. Just give us an option of a request.
My concern there would be, of course, I don't think a commission would do this, but who knows? You know, they report, and 6 months later, some other folks get elected, and they decide they want to hear a report, or there's pressure put on the commission from a particular area of the state, and they decide, well, we better have another one, and it becomes a political challenge there. I do agree that it should be at least somewhere in the three-year vicinity.
The commission accordingly directs Keystone to keep abreast of the latest of developments and technologies and shall report to the commission on the status of innovations in such pipeline leak detection equipment methods when requested by the commission no more often than every 3 years. And I would take out the reference to 2010 because to me, if we're just saying that when we ask for the information, they've got to provide it, that makes more sense than formalizing some sort of a report schedule.
I don't mean to be cantankerous here or anything. I like the April 1st, 2010 being in. The sentence that you added at the end of that, that we presently have, is certainly acceptable and in the spirit of what we're talking about. Would you repeat that? I had said reporting every 3 years at the commission's request, and I think you were saying something reporting not more than every 3 years at the commission's request.
And I don't mind putting April 1st, 2010 back in. Could we have a sunset date? To me, that's just a lot more defensible from a legal standpoint. And I don't have anything specific in mind, but to me, we need to, I think, try to tie it to this particular proceeding rather than some ongoing newfound jurisdiction that
Commissioner, excuse me, I'll do it. Commissioner Colbeck, you had expressed concern about that earlier.
No, actually, I understand what Commissioner Johnson's getting at is we need to make sure that it pertains to us and our commission as we sit here today and not future commissions and future authority that's not granted. I liked his sentence that he had stated, and I think that if we mention the two, the not to exceed every 3 years, I think it's a good idea. But to leave April 1st, 2010 in, that would be the first one, and then we'd continue on from there with Commissioner Johnson's sentence at the end.
Did you have a sunset date, Commissioner Kolbeck, that would be acceptable to you?
Technology is moving very rapidly, but gosh, I would think that nothing sooner than 2015 would be my sunset date, which would give us...
That's only two reports.
That's why I would like the commission request, because a different time, a different day, it's like, well, these reports are a burden to the company, they're a burden to the commission. Maybe the information isn't coming out. I guess it's hard to predict if technology is going to meet or exceed standards, how quickly that will happen.
And I think one concern I have about this request is that, I mean, we won't know. I mean, we do have engineers on staff. We do understand siting dockets. We do have that in place. I mean, one of the issues about receiving these reports is, are we going to hire a consultant to review them for accuracy? Are we going to know exactly what the technology means or what's been omitted? To me, I'm increasingly disliking this condition. Now, I understand and respect the fact that you all see some value. To me, if we can put a sunset date on it, it becomes at least acceptable.
I guess I view them as kind of similar to our gas hedging meetings that we have, or annual reports, or some of the electrical companies that they give. Why would you consider them to be different than that?
Because those are, we have broad authority over the regulation of the operation of those companies. And these companies, this company, it's economically, it's regulated by FERC. Environmentally, it's regulated by a slew of departments and agencies, and we don't have a grant of authority to do this, in my opinion.
Well, and that actually poses more doubt that the FERC rulings are what's going to make them change their SCADA system, if they have to come into compliance with their FERC rulings, or their PHMSA, PHMSA rulings.
May I offer a sentence that would read, reporting not more than every 3 years thereafter at the Commission's request until the year 2022. Can that get us off the dime?
Can we peel it back to sometime before 2020? And that is a long time down the road. I mean...
Well, they're reporting at 2010, and it only gives... If it's reporting every 3 years, that's only four reports.
Well, it would also be four reports at 2019. I mean, it's not much of a practical difference. I just...
That's three reports.
10, 13, 16, and 19.
Excuse me. And 3 years later at 2022. Excuse me. I was adding the 2010. And is that a problem? If
it's not a problem with me.
At 2019 or?
At 2020.
I mean, if we're looking for four reports, 2019 gets us there, and for me, the sticker shock is less if we don't go into another decade, and I know that's arbitrary and absurd, but this is going to be a lot to swallow as it is.
Well, I'm going from 2019
here. just don't start talking in your auctioneer language and really lose me. No, 2019 is okay with me. Four reports, I think, is not a huge burden, yet I think it's a good amount of information. I can get off the dime for 2019.
All right. We're going to go with a sentence that we'll read, and I don't mind if Mr. Smith polishes it up, but the spirit of the sentence will state, reporting not more than every 3 years thereafter at the Commission's request until the year 2019. Do we have agreement?
Excellent. Next section deals with environmental conditions. Condition 48, except to the extent waived by the owner or lessee in writing, or to the extent the noise levels already exceed such standard, the noise levels associated with Keystone's pump station and other noise-producing facilities will not exceed the L10 55 decibel A standard at the nearest occupied existing residence, office, hotel, motel, or non-industrial business not owned by Keystone. The point of measurement will be within 100 feet of the residence or business in the direction of the pump station facility. Post-construction operational noise assessments will be completed by an independent third-party noise consultant approved by the Commission to show compliance with the noise level at each pump station or other noise-producing facility. The noise assessments will be performed in accordance with the applicable American National Standards Institute standards. The results of the assessments will be filed with the Commission. In the event the noise level exceeds the limits set forth in this condition at any pump station or other noise-producing facility, Keystone shall promptly implement noise mitigation measures to bring the facility into compliance with the limits set forth in this condition and shall report to the Commission concerning the measures taken and the results of post-mitigation assessments demonstrating that the noise limits have been met. Are there any concerns with condition 48?
Is 55 decibels, is that what we've set for Groton 2 and for our Groton 1 and our other hearings? Is anybody?
Yes.
Okay, great, thanks.
This language was taken essentially from the Groton and Groton 2 permits.
Thank you. Condition 49. At the request of any landowner or public water supply system that offers to provide the necessary access to Keystone over his or her property or easements to perform the necessary work, Keystone shall replace at no cost to such landowner or public water supply system any polyethylene water piping located within 500 feet of the project. Keystone shall not be required to replace that portion of any piping that passes through or under a basement wall or other wall of a home or other structure. At least 45 days prior to commencing construction, Keystone shall publish a notice in at least one newspaper of general circulation in each county through which the project will be constructed, advising landowners and public water supply systems of this condition. Are there any concerns on 49?
And I don't have any concerns. The reason I think this one is important is I think there is adequate evidence in the record that PVC pipe is not particularly susceptible to being permeated by hydrocarbon products. That evidence doesn't really exist to the same extent in the record with regard to polyethylene pipe, and I think with this we can ensure that landowners within the proximity of the pipeline will be better protected than they otherwise would have been.
Any concerns? Item condition 50. If during construction Keystone or its agents discover what may be an archaeological resource, cultural resource, paleontological resource, historical resource, or gravesite, Keystone or its agents shall immediately cease work at that portion of the site and notify the Commission and the State Historical Preservation Office. If the SHPO determines a protectable resource is present, Keystone shall develop a plan that is acceptable to this SHPO. I'm sure there's a way to pronounce that acronym. SHPO? To salvage, avoid, or protect the archaeological resource. If such a plan will require a different route than that approved by the Commission, Keystone shall obtain Commission approval for the new route before proceeding with any further construction. Are there any concerns on Condition 50? Condition 51. Keystone shall promptly report to the Commission the presence in the permit area of any critical habitat of threatened or endangered species that Keystone becomes aware of and that were not previously reported to the Commission. Any concerns on 51? 52.
Keystone shall keep a record of drain tile system information throughout construction. Location information shall be collected using a sub-meter accuracy global positioning system, where available, or where not available, by accurately documenting the pipeline station numbers of each exposed drain tile. Keystone shall maintain the drain tile location information and tile specifications and incorporate it into its emergency response and integrity management plans where drains might be expected to serve as contaminant conduits in the event of a release. Are there any concerns over 52? Liability for damage is the next section, the last section. Item 53. Keystone shall repair or replace all property removed or damaged during all phases of construction and operation of the proposed transmission facility, including but not limited to all fences, gates, and irrigation of drainage systems. Keystone shall compensate the owners for damages or losses that cannot be fully remedied by repair or replacement, such as lost productivity and crop and livestock losses. Are there any concerns with item 53? Condition 54. In the event that a person's well is contaminated as a result of the pipeline operation, Keystone shall pay all costs associated with finding and providing a permanent water supply that is at least of similar quality and quantity, and any other related damages, including but not limited to any consequences, medical or otherwise, related to water contamination. Are there any concerns over 54? 55. Any damage that occurs as a result of soil disturbance on a person's property shall be paid for by Keystone. Any concerns on 55? 56. No person will be held responsible for a pipeline leak that occurs as a result of his or her normal farming practices over the top of or near the pipeline. Any concerns on 56? 57. Keystone shall pay commercially reasonable costs and indemnify and hold the landowner harmless for any loss, damage, claim, or action resulting from Keystone's use of the easement, except to the extent such loss, damage, claim, or action results from the gross negligence or willful misconduct of the landowner or its agents. Any concerns on condition 57? Hearing none, those are the conditions. I believe we've, in spirit, agreed with all of them. We will entertain a motion to approve them at this time and then have any discussion that anyone wishes to pursue.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to amend the main motion with the inclusion of the discussed conditions.
There is a motion to approve the conditions 1 through 57 inclusive and amend the main motion with that. Do you wish to discuss that motion at this time, or do you wish to discuss the main motion after we've voted on this portion?
To me, Mr. Chairman, just attaching these onto the main motion and then discussing the whole enchilada probably makes sense.
Commissioner Kobach, is that satisfactory?
Absolutely.
Then we have a motion to amend the main motion by adding conditions 1 through 57 inclusive. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kobach?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. The main motion is amended to include the conditions as we have agreed to here. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back to the main motion as amended, and I certainly have things that I would like to say, but I would love to hear what my compatriots have to say at this time, so allow them to chat.
You want to go first or second?
I'll go first. I guess even though the pipeline actually has 51 tons of force to puncture the pipeline, which is an extraordinary amount, our order specifies that normal farming activity will not be held responsible. The order also states that the company must provide $12 million in bonding to fix roads until we release that bond. I feel very good about that. Our state DNR has testified that they can handle the project this size if something was to happen. They testified they handle hundreds of hydrocarbon releases a year. And their May 1st contact with the company was in, and that their first contact with this company was in February of 05, contrary to the theory that this was pushed through. Federal law states any release must be cleaned up at the company's expense, and the company has testified that they will if something happens. Unfortunately, most concerns about the pipeline were due to the route, and we do not have jurisdiction over the route. A lot of concerns were about mistreatment or misunderstandings with land agents concerning easements. And again, we do not approve of such behavior, but we do not have jurisdiction over those matters. And some concerns which upset me the most were caused by gross misstatements of fact in the case. Anyone who tries to put fear in landowners' minds or hearts with the misrepresentation of facts has done a misservice to their neighbors, in my opinion. Multiple divisions of South Dakota state government have been involved for just over 3 years. County commissioners were informed, legislators were informed, and numerous officials. The PUC, however, has been working on their part for 11 months. I feel we did do a very thorough and detailed analysis of the pipeline and utilized our legislative granted authority to the maximum I thought possible. I feel we made extraordinary steps to keep the process open. I understand the fear, and I understand the love of the land. And I understand that no one knows what will happen in 50, the 10, or 5 years from now. The pipeline may be carrying ethanol or soy diesel. We don't know. I don't know. But I do feel comfortable with the conditions we have put on this pipeline, and I feel it will be held to a safe and accountable manner. So on the initial motion, I vote aye.
I'll make some comments too if it's acceptable, Mr. Chairman. This commission, by law must, you know, base its decision on facts and evidence, and I think that fact has been very helpful to me, to focus on the facts rather than the rhetoric, because several major concerns I had at the beginning of the process, and there are concerns that I think have been shared by many people across the state, those concerns were alleviated a great deal as a part of this process. There are three key facts in the record that I think I'd like to bring out quickly. First, the pipelines are safe and getting safer. In the last 5 years, the number of spills on crude oil pipelines has decreased 57%. And for 28 years, TransCanada has been applying fusion bonded epoxy along with cathodic protection to their pipelines. In that time, the record shows that none of those pipelines have had a leak. Secondly, that oil pipelines are usually small. The data indicates that 90% of crude oil spills are less than 300 barrels. And in fact, since 2002, the median spill size in this country has been 3 barrels. And the final fact I'd like to bring out is that South Dakota has dealt with spills successfully. As Commissioner Colbeck noted, our state DNR has experience with this. They have a database of more than 11,000 hazardous material releases that have happened in this state. And they testified that no permanent natural resource damage has ever occurred as a part of a hazardous material spill in this state. The conditions I think that we have just approved of the main motion are good ones, and I think they're reasonable. There are no doubt some that would have preferred that the commission go a lot further, that we require that the applicant double the thickness of the pipe, or that we require that the applicant pay a particular dollar amount for easements. And I think ultimately it comes down to whether you want a commission that follows the law or a commission that plays political games. And we could have ignored the law to score political points. And if that would have been the case, our decision would have been overturned by a higher court, and then we could have made the court out to be the bad guy. Instead, I am proud that I think it appears like this commission will choose to make a difficult, but what I believe is the proper decision. In its reply brief, one of the opponents of this pipeline referenced the Titanic and the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings. See, they essentially said, man-made things fail, so this pipeline should not be approved. And actually, I took a very different lesson from their example. Because despite the tragedies of the World Trade Center, and despite the tragedy of the Titanic, we haven't quit building ships, and we haven't quit building buildings. We haven't been paralyzed by the problems of the past, and instead we have learned from those tragedies, and we've made improvements through technologies and safeguards and standards, and those improvements have made everybody's life a little bit better. And that's exactly what has happened and what is happening in the pipeline industry, and the numbers prove it. I will close by noting that some will attempt to boil down the literally hundreds of exhibits and 20,000 pages of testimony and comment into 30-second sound bites that don't accurately reflect the record. That's inevitable but unfortunate. This was a long process for a reason. There are 57 conditions attached to the main motion for a reason. There was a lot of work to get done, and I think there were a lot of questions answered. I believe this project has met its burden under state law, and as a result, I will be voting yes on the pending motion. And Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Colbeck, and everyone else involved in the process, thank you for your countless hours of hard work.
One of the opportunities of going last is that I can be more succinct because I could cross things off as you folks articulated your thoughts. I would like to make an announcement, first of all, to facilitate the news media, because of the interest shown in this docket. After the commission votes on the conditions and the final motion, we will take a 30-minute recess. We will then return to this room to answer news media questions. There's a little bit of a challenge in that from the standpoint, of course, that there are a number of news personnel who are not here who would certainly like to ask questions who are listening over the webcast. The webcast will continue, and those news persons who are interested in asking questions but who are not present may obtain a telephone bridge by calling the PUC office at 773-3201 and asking for Leah Moore. There are a limited number of bridges available, so if you would like to... Gosh, I shouldn't have said that just before I make my comments. Then that way all the news media doesn't pay attention to what I'm saying. But I appreciate the statements, the eloquent statements by my fellow two commissioners, and I do very much appreciate working with both of them. This has been not necessarily an arduous task by any means, but it's been a task. And when I think of all of the work that we have had to do as commissioners, and then I reflect on the amount of work that staff had to do in order to provide that information, go through the process, I really, truly appreciate the tremendous amount of work that staff went through. With every docket, this commission wants to get it right. We want to be absolutely certain that we make the right decision when it comes to our dockets. We're especially concerned that we get it right the first time, and this one of the big reasons is that for this docket especially is that this docket may very well serve as a precedent to future pipelines. Certainly future commissions are not totally strapped by any means to what position this commission takes. However, this commission and working through this process does, in essence, set somewhat of a precedent for future pipelines. And with the proposed refinery, there will be no doubt pipelines associated with that. So it's especially true that we need to get this prepared the right way the first time. Mitigation and remediation are of utmost concern to us. Our state's natural environment must not be unnecessarily disturbed. Our water, our air, and soils are not replaceable assets, and they must be selfishly protected. Eminent domain, during the process, we were contacted numerous times regarding easements and eminent domain. Frankly, it's important to us that our citizens' property rights are not trampled. At the same time, we, during that process, expressed several times, numerous times through the news media, that we, in fact, as a commission, have no legal authority over eminent domain. As my fellow commissioners have stated, there's
a process here that we are required by law to go through. And it's incumbent upon us to do the right thing, to follow the law, to apply the law as it should be applied. We have, through that process, there was an obfuscation that took place that of an attempt to create a challenge amongst the citizenry who we serve that in some way that we do, in fact, should be making decisions and stepping in the path of the court, the legal process. That was a disservice, as Commissioner Kolbeck pointed out. That was one of the disservices to the citizenry because they were led to believe that we, in fact, had this authority when we, in fact, did not. As I started out this my words on this docket, I started to thank the staff people, and I would like to thank also the applicant. I would like to thank the interveners. I would like to thank the staff council that represented the citizens of South Dakota. I don't know how many of you in the audience are aware, but that is the way the PUC is structured. There are staff council, staff attorneys who represent the citizens, and as the commissioners do not chat back and forth between ourselves, we certainly do not discuss with them because they are a separate party to this docket. So I thank them profusely for their work. I'd also like to say thank you to John Smith, who, and there are others I should probably point out by name for the work that they did, but John just did a tremendous amount of work on this, working till late in the evenings, early in the mornings, many times, reading every document, pouring through them numerous times, and we are truly indebted to him for his work. I especially appreciate the citizens who are affected by this pipeline and thank them for their participation as well as we went through this process, their participation and their patience as we went through it, because when your property is being affected by any entity, it has to be a challenge, and so we sincerely appreciate their participation and patience as we went through this process. If there is not anything further to state at this time, we are back to a main motion as amended. Is there any further discussion on the main motion as amended? If not, Commissioner Johnson?
I vote aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes aye. The main motion as amended carries. And we thank all of you for your participation. We will be at recess until 20 minutes after, I believe that's one, is that clock been turned forward?
25.
We'll call it 25 minutes after 1 o'clock. Who was, excuse us, folks, we're just having a little bit of a situation here.
You're on the web.
All right, great. Thank you very much. Always look to the news media to find out where you are and what you're doing.
You're in a world of trouble if you do that.
Well, we are here for you to have your way with us. How's that? And this is an extremely important docket to us and certainly to the rest of the citizens of South Dakota. And we thought it would facilitate matters if, instead of you folks having to try and track us down, if we just made ourselves available. So that's what we're doing here. And you have the three commissioners at your whim, so fire at us.
That was a key concern as you went through this. I know, Steve, you talked a lot about concerns about protection of landowners and concern about some tactics, and Dusty and Gary both made some comments about that. But the overarching concern through this whole process, what was going on the top of your mind?
Well, on the
As we went through the process, we were obviously contained. You wouldn't ask a Supreme Court judge if he thought someone was guilty. That was actually at the top of my mind, was trying to keep the ex parte rules and everything together during this docket. It was very frustrating not to be able to set the record straight or to respond to letters to the editor or other things like that. But there is a lot of facts out there. There are considerable amount of facts on our website, and I encourage anybody to go and look at those if they have any questions.
I think, Jerry, this is Dusty. You know, my biggest concern was just making sure we found out what the truth really was. You know, I think all three of us were focused on, you know, how likely is a spill and how big would a spill be and how quickly can you respond and how completely can you remediate it. And we were really searching that truth for ourselves so that we could make a good decision. But it also helps if the public knows what the reality is, because obviously we want the public to have confidence in their Public Utilities Commission, confidence that we're working for them, that we're working in the public interest. And, you know, hopefully this decision can also help to educate some people on what the real truth of all those issues I brought up, what the truth is.
And I'm sorry, Jerry, this is Steve again. Just one of the things that was maybe brought up, and there were numerous things, but that the pipe, that the oil is actually heated. It's not. Friction of the oil creates heat. That was one misrepresentation. But if I was to come out and try to correct that fact, would that be interpreted as I was for or against the pipeline? That was the trouble. That's what was troubling in my mind.
Jerry, this is Gary Hansen. It's hard to say what a major concern was, because there were so many. The major concern, I guess, that I was most prevalent in my mind was to get it right, simply because I felt this was setting a precedent. We're, none of us here are unfamiliar with politics. It's most frustrating not to be able to deal with misinformation, and I think that's one of the challenges when you're in somewhat of a quasi-judicial situation like we are, where we can't respond to it, we can't set the record straight as we're going through the process. We wanted to make certain that we followed the law. We wanted to make certain that we, especially that we protect the natural resources and that we protect the interests of the citizens. And I'm, frankly, I'm very pleased with the results of the process and the work product that the commission was, and I'll say the commission, meaning all, not just the commissioners, but all of the folks and staff people at the commission who put this product together. Other questions? You guys aren't going to make it that easy on us, are you?
Well, let me ask you one again from a parochial point of view, since Yankton is going to see the pipeline come through the city limits here in terms of the conditions and also the river crossing here. You know, how much of a special case is that going to be?
We will be – a note was just handed to me. Excuse me, Jerry. Would you please identify yourselves when you ask a question, because we are archiving this as part of the docket process and what we're doing as commission. So if that was Jerry Oster, if you would please.
It was indeed.
If you would identify yourselves when you ask us a question. And I suppose we should identify ourselves when we answer the question.
I'm willing to jump, put a toe in the water at least.
Please do. I was reading the notice as he was asking, so I'll pick up after.
You know, Jerry, this is Dusty Johnson. You asked specifically about Yankton, and just off the top of my head, I can think of three things where Yankton and that river crossing was treated specially by either the federal government or this commission. You know, first off, one of the 57 conditions that the commission put in place dealt with how to deal with residences and residential areas. And to be real honest, we don't have a lot of those throughout the, you know, 220-mile route in South Dakota other than near Yankton. And so I do think Yankton's going to be given some special treatment there. Secondly, the PHMSA permit, the permit from the federal government, didn't apply to river crossings for navigable rivers that have year-round flow like the Missouri River. And so you're going to see a different thickness of the pipe underneath the Missouri River. You're going to see you're going to have check valves at both sides of the Missouri River. You're going to have a number of precautions that the federal government required or that TransCanada put into place voluntarily. And then, you know, finally, the last of the big three that comes to my mind is just going to be response time. You know, TransCanada has not promised that they'll have response teams in any particular geographic location, to my knowledge, in any place except Yankton, where they have said, yes, we will have a team in Yankton, because we want to have, you know, the fastest response time possible with regard to that river crossing. And so I think Yankton has been, that river crossing and that community has been very much in consideration at all of the different agencies that have reviewed this project.
One another thing specific to Yankton is if there was a water release in the Missouri River, that actually is not the state DNR. That's actually controlled by the federal federal government. And that fund that actually goes to a different fund. That is not dipping out of South Dakota's fund for hydrocarbon release. That's actually on the federal side. So that's another thing that's different about Yankton.
This is Gary Hansen, Jerry. One of the things that most concerned me about Yankton was my experience as the utilities commissioner and as mayor of Sioux Falls with actual leaks and the challenges that result from those leaks. And so I certainly wanted to be certain that we went through a process that would assure us that that it would be as least likely as possible for a leak to take place. The proximity to occupied property and businesses was of quite a big concern. But I am also familiar with the city of Sioux Falls, where there are pipelines running right through the city. And certainly those, it's a different type of product that's going through some of those pipelines. But at the same time, those pipelines are carrying products that are far more likely to create significant challenges than a crude oil pipeline are. So that's something that I guess anytime I see pipelines around occupied buildings, whether they're residences or businesses, that gives me that just creates that concern as a result of the experiences that I've had in having to clean those up as a local government official. Further questions?
This is Scott Waltman up at the American News in Aberdeen. I guess I'm curious if there was a agency or perhaps water group or something like that that didn't approve the decision. Is there an appeal process for them? I am not aware of that, and maybe you guys would be.
I'm going to look to our counsel, since that's a legal question, make sure we get it right.
Thank you, Commissioner Hansen. And may I clarify, was the question again whether there's an appeal process from the decision that the commission made today?
Yes.
Yes, there is. Under the South Dakota Administrative Procedures Act, any person who was a party to the case, any of the interveners, or in fact the TransCanada Keystone, has the right to appeal by filing a notice of appeal to the appropriate circuit court, and there's a couple of options they would have, several options depending on where they live, within 30 days after we issue the final decision, which didn't happen today. That will happen when we issue the formal written decision and serve it. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
And from there, then, a person would also have the right to appeal to the South Dakota Supreme Court.
And, Scott, this is Dusty. I would just note that, you know, we have experience with that. We did have our decision on Big Stone 2 that we rendered in the summer of 2006 was appealed. We won at Circuit Court, and we won at the Supreme Court. And, in fact, that decision had some wording that I think makes it pretty clear what the commission should be looking at with regard to that siting statute. So we have won appeals at the Supreme Court before.
Other questions?
This is Scott Walton again. I'll go once more if nobody else does. I mean, it's clear you kind of had a nod to some of the, and I'm kind of probably thinking about the Marshall County area more than anything else, but some of the aquifers and water, water sources up there. Could you just talk about, kind of your thoughts as you kind of crafted, I know there were 57, you know, points that were talked about this morning, but, just kind of as they were, as they relate to, water sources, I was, sometimes the list got going pretty fast this morning, I guess.
Scott, this is Gary Hansen. We were, all three of us were especially concerned with that and found out subsequent to our work on this that we all had expressed interest in protecting that sands area up in the, up and around the area that you're referring to. We took a number of steps and you're right, as we went through the process, it was rather interesting for us as we went through the process because some of the paragraphs, the conditions as we were working with them ended up being rewritten and ending up in different pages of the draft than what we had looked at previously. So in many respects, it was as if we were looking at a new draft each time. But we did consider that of paramount importance and I'm not sure whether or not this draft and how soon we are going to be able to have this on the web. Can anyone tell me? Anyone know how?
Of the conditions,
yes.
You mean? It'll probably be up to me, of course, to finish the edits that the commission voted on today. And I would assume I could have that done here within an hour or so, an hour or two.
Great.
And I would assume we'd post it immediately as soon as that's done.
Okay, good. And then you'll be able to refer to those areas. One of the areas that you want to refer to is towards the end. It's the environmental conditions and discusses the, it's, begins with condition 48. Some of the conditions not only protect are directly, for the purpose of protecting the aquifer, they're also for the purpose of protecting wells and protecting the supply lines, that, for instance, the polyethylene pipelines, to assure that there's no degradation in those areas.
This is Dusty Johnson, and Gary just talking just kind of reminded me of something. I mean, I think, Scott, there are probably people out there that will view this decision as a victory for TransCanada, and I would suspect that the applicant is going to be pretty happy with the announcements, but I think it's also a victory for a lot of the people who intervened, because you look at, of course, there were 57 conditions, but I have just jotted down while we're talking six of them that I think are maybe the most important or interesting, and a lot of them deal directly with issues that were raised by interveners. Things like, you know, the polyethylene pipes, things like, public liaison officers so they can make sure they're being communicated with properly. The Middle James Aquifer, making sure that we do what we can to protect that and plan for taking care of that. I think every one of the six most important conditions were raised by interveners. And, you know, if you look at the law, we have three options before us. We can approve, we can deny, or we can approve with conditions. And the Public Utilities Commission did not approve the permit. We approved with conditions. And a lot of those conditions, you know, we can thank the interveners for raising the issues.
Just kind of on a different note about Marshall County, I know there was a lot of concern about the route up there and how it took. And I think one thing that was kind of miscommunicated and actually confused me a little bit is the alternate route that was proposed actually moved it closer to the BDM well, which I didn't understand at all. But I think the route that was chosen, we couldn't adjust or modify anyway, but I think that the route did take into effect hydrological studies, population studies, geographical studies. All of that was done as part of the permit. I know the alternate route that they had proposed had none of those things done to it, but maybe that might address some of your concerns up there around Marshall County, too.
Scott Waltman again. Just, I guess, what Dusty just said sparked a question. Approved with conditions, which means they can move forward, but in the future have to show evidence that they're complying with the 57 conditions. Is that fair to say, or am I getting ahead of the game?
No, that's certainly fair to say.
Okay.
And Scott, this is Steve Kolbeck again. With the permit from the federal government, they had 81 conditions, plus the 57 conditions that we put on there. I think that brings the total up to around 140 conditions, extra conditions, to be able to even start construction.
Well, and this is Dusty Johnson. When you look at the three options, you know, approve, deny, or approve upon certain terms and conditions, I mean, I think our approval today is that TransCanada didn't get what it wanted. TransCanada got what we wanted. We took their application, which I think was a good application, but we put some things in that, frankly, they didn't ask for. They probably didn't want, but interveners wanted. You know, TransCanada didn't call for them to have a public liaison officer, you know, accountable to us 24 hours a day. They didn't ask to out of their own pocket replace polyethylene pipes or to, you know, treat the Middle James Aquifer, you know, differently. And there are others. I mean, this really is a pipeline with protections in place that the commission felt were necessary.
This is Gary Hansen again. In going through this process, we wanted sincerely to protect the citizens, and that should be a given. But at the same time, we needed to be careful that in those areas where we were perhaps stretching the envelope of our authority, that we didn't wish to stretch it too much because, number one, we didn't want it to be overturned, and we didn't want to give, create the desire for Keystone to pursue that either. So we wanted to make certain that we had sufficient restrictions, sufficient safeguards, and you probably heard during the discussion that some of us were, in fact, a little uncomfortable as we went into some of those territories. But at the same end, certainly Keystone has a right to be concerned about that if we trespass into areas where our authority does not exist. At the same time, it's not in their interest to pursue a court case on this, provided that we don't go too far. So it was one of those situations where we wanted to remain within our authority, but at the same time, we, granted, may have stretched it just a smidgen, and enough so that we wouldn't be overturned.
Well, and I think one thing that impressed, this is Dusty, and one thing that impressed me about this process, and frankly impressed me about my colleagues, is there is a tremendous desire when you're an elected official to want to please people. And I think the decision today, I think, shows that the commissioners were not interested in merely political pandering, but they were interested, as Commissioner Hansen has put it, in getting it right, in following the law, not putting a bunch of conditions into place that are not defensible. You know, this is a commission, you know, this decision today, I think, is a good thing because it shows that this commission can work through what the right decision is and not just what the popular decision for any given person or any given county might be.
Further questions? This is Gary. I've served on a lot of different bodies of commissions and legislature and things of that nature, and this is a real unique one from a standpoint of, I guess I would call it the finality of the decisions that we make here, even though that they can be appealed. It's, and perhaps Commissioner Kolbeck, who served on a local commission council as well, recognizes that people have the ability when you make a decision on a legislative level, they can always come back with different legislation next year. When you're in a city council position, they can come back in 6 months, or they can work other ways in which to change things. And in this process, it's extremely important for us to get it right, especially
issues of this nature that affect so many people and have the potential to affect our environment for, well, forever. And so I think that's one of the things that strikes me the most about working on the commission level. Other questions?
I'd just like to make one comment that I know some people, whether there's a winning side or a losing side, some people feel that they were mistreated, and I just want to make it known that I feel that this process was very open. We're on the Internet, every meeting, all of our stuff is on the Internet, all of our dockets, all of the transcripts, everything we said. It's been an 11-month process to do that. As I said before, the state has been working on this for three years, a little over 3 years. And I think that some of the things that came out, like a thinner pipe, may have overclouded some people's thoughts. And when you really get down to brass tacks, it's actually 43/1000ths of an inch difference in the thickness of the wall of a pipe. That, I think, maybe overshadowed some of the law and some of the openness that was out there. I hope no one feels slighted by that, but I feel that we've done a very good job of getting anyone and everyone involved and giving them proper time to comment.
This is Dusty, and Steve, that's a great point. In fact, for that instance, we had some people who were saying that the pipeline operating under that federal permit with, quote, a thinner pipe would be more dangerous, when in fact the federal regulators have made it very clear that it's going to be as safe or safer than if they wouldn't have had that special permit. And, again, part of this is an education process, and I don't expect that every intervener would have read all 20,000 pages, but sometimes the misinformation was a little disheartening.
Further questions? Any comments by the commissioners at this juncture? I won't ask any of our staff people for their comment. They might have something really challenging for us. Scott, Gary, Dawn, Travis, and Jerry. Any further?
I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you, folks, very, very much for following this up. We appreciate the work that you do, too. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. We don't even take a motion for that, do we?
Motion to adjourn.
The meeting is adjourned.